And good Monday morning. It's Wendy Snyder here. And Bill Leff will be taking the week off. Not sure what he's up to. I think he's at the U.S. Mint trying to get a boat full of dimes to bother me. I left the show on Friday because it's not that I don't like dimes. It's if you're getting change, you need to 40 cents shouldn't be four dimes.
I'm pretty sure you just don't like dimes.
No, it's not really that. It's just they're little and I want to get a quarter when possible. That would be it. And I left in a huff on Friday. Sorry, I had to leave early. That's not why I left. Although people all over Facebook, I'll bet you a dime that the Bears win. Stop the dime stuff. But speaking of a Bears win, I've asked Dave Ennett to stick around because I don't know what the term is for opposite of a sports widow, because I was a sports wife. I mean, I don't know how I sat on the couch and watched sports all weekend.
So what you're saying, what would be the opposite of that? So
of a sports widow.
Well, sports widower.
No, because I was sitting there with Jimmy Mack.
Okay.
So, I mean, we were both there. I just want to tell you, first of all, Saturday night watching the Hawks. Dave, the pressure's now on to tweet all the action.
I know. I was seeing your tweets. I was like, wow, you're praising the Bears and then the Hawks.
But you know what else I did was, all right, so Saturday night we had the Hawks game. I want to just say, if I may, and we'll be talking to Judd Surratt later on this morning. Actually, this afternoon, I think part two, we're going to talk to Judd. That's Andrea. Oh, we're hearing some phone numbers.
Yes.
Kevin, we can hear that in here. It's Andrea's loud enough, and then amplifier. Holy moly. All right, so the Hawks, to me, look like the Hawks again now that Duncan Keith is back.
Well, it makes a huge difference. And I've said this to a couple of people. Anybody who thought you can take all these guys off this team and just not skip a beat, it's unrealistic to think that way. And so you had Keith out, and you had, of course, you also had Roosevelt out, and you had Hose out for a few games. Then take away the other guys who were no longer part of the team that won the Stanley Cup, and it's bound to have an effect. Now you have some nice new pieces, but they're all getting used to each other, and now you've kind of got everybody together.
It's gelling like Magellan.
Yeah,
I don't know what that stupid ad campaign is, but
you know what? You look at their record. And I know this was pointed out a couple times on the broadcast that their record is the same as it was last year with all those guys who won the Stanley Cup.
I said that to Bill Leff last week, and he goes, really?" I said, "Yes," and they won.
You know why? It doesn't feel that way at times, and partly because they've always been a good road team, and they've struggled on the road up until Saturday night, when they won their first road game and they won their most recent road game. But I think what's interesting is you look at the way they've played at home, and aside from they had the hiccup against St. Louis where they blew the big lead. And
yeah,
then the other night, just you know, they just couldn't get a goal and they ended up losing. But they're 8-2-1 at the United Center, which is the second best record, I believe, behind the surging red-hot New York Rangers, who have the best record in the league, at home. So now they go on the road. They've usually done really well on this road trip, and we'll see how they do.
All right. So when Brandon Saad got traded, I was bummed. But Artemi Panarin seems to be pretty great. And his little gelling with Kane is amazing. Patrick Kane doing amazing. 13 games in a row where he scored. I am blown away.
Seven straight with a goal, which, you know, he's starting to get into the sort of the stratosphere as far as goal scoring streaks in Blackhawks history.
It's awesome.
And if you look at it, he's now playing, if you remember, right before he got hurt last year in the spring, he was on a similar kind of hot streak, and he had taken the lead among all NHL scorers, and then he broke the clavicle, and that was that until he came back in the playoffs. Well, now he's kind of picked up where he left off before he got hurt. Not that he didn't play well in the playoffs, but he's scoring the way he did, and he obviously has this nice chemistry with Panarin.
Isn't that great to watch?
It really is fun to watch. So between them and you know, now you got Hossa,
who's
been playing well, but he just hasn't had the scoring, and last night he fires one in to give the Blackhawks the lead.
Floodgates are open with
Hossa. How about Brent Seabrook coming back after he gets his he gets the puck in the face.
Yep.
And he comes back. They stitch him up and they send him back out.
I know. I tweeted all about that at Wendy Snyder. Also, Duncan Keith back, 27 minutes in that game?
He's just back. 28 minutes on Saturday night, yeah.
All right. It was too exciting. So that's Saturday. And then Sunday happens, and I haven't been watching the Bears games. My husband said, please watch the Bears. I said, all right, I'll watch the Bears. And Jeremy Langford is in because Matt Forte's out. Is Matt Forte coming back in? Because Jeremy Langford is awesome.
Well, Forte will still come back. We don't know if he'll play this week. Maybe he'll be back this week. Maybe next week. I think the assumption was he'd be out a few games. I asked Adam Hoge about this on the air this morning because clearly you've got a guy who's going to be a special player for them. But you still have Matt Forte, who's been a great player over the years.
Yep.
And now it's just a great situation because you've got Forte coming back at some point, and you've got Langford, and he's going to get in there. He's going to need to get touches. And then this other Kadeem Carey ran the ball well yesterday too. So you've kind of gone from a unsettled situation to at least having some confidence. You got some guys there you can give the ball to and throw the ball to.
Two in a row.
And really not just that they won two in a row. And look, I don't think either of the teams they've beaten. I thought St. Louis just played a terrible game. The Bears had something to do with that. You know, so I thought San Diego's a team that's been going downhill this year.
A win's a win, Dave.
No, absolutely. Oh, don't get me wrong. And the Bears aren't in any position to look any wind, to turn out any wind. But
right.
I just think that they're playing, obviously they're enjoying it now. It's a little more fun. You can tell guys are having a good time out there. And it's going to be neat to watch. This team, look, they're 4-5. So they're not where they're ultimately hoping to be yet, but it's still a lot more fun to watch than what we've seen the last few years.
Oh, absolutely. And then, so, opposite of a sports widow, I'm sitting on the couch, watch the Bears, then it's NASCAR time because Jeff Gordon will be retiring after this.
Yep.
It's raining in Phoenix. It's so odd that happens. They're taking the giant contraptions that vacuum the water. Mm-hmm. The race never went off. But so I'm watching a little of that. And then, of course, the Hawks, again, a win last night.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan Toews is just amped up.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And I can tell you're sending little messages to him on Twitter.
I'm just tagging him.
Way to go, Captain.
Yeah, I mean, who knows who might see it? And Scott Darling did a fantastic job last night.
But the Blackhawks are so fortunate because Corey Crawford had a good game on Saturday night, and then Darling last night. He's won a couple of games for them so far this year, and they're in a good situation.
I'm turning into a sports chick.
You missed the Bulls. They picked up a nice win on Friday night, right?
See, that's the one thing I can't get into.
We got another one tonight against the Pacers, I believe.
Against the Pacers, that's right. And don't forget college football. Don't forget those Northwestern Wildcats.
Yes, go Cats.
There you go.
I haven't watched a game ever, but I've heard you on the radio.
But you can.
I've heard you making the call, Dave, and it's pretty exciting.
Well, thanks.
And then Walking Dead, The Walking Dead after all that. So I really, I did a shower beer, and then I relaxed on the couch and planted it and watched sports.
A shower beer?
When you have a beer. Kevin, explain the shower beer, will you? Bill had never heard of it. Obviously, Dave hasn't either.
This new phenomenon where you have a beer in the shower.
You actually carry the beer into the shower with you?
Yeah.
Well, you put it off to the side. I need both hands to do what I do in the shower, which is wash my hair.
Just make sure to concentrate before you condition.
Remember that shampoo body on tap that was allegedly there was beer in there? It's a good cream rinse. All right. Steve Bertrand will be sitting in for Bill Leff, I think most of the week, but he has a very pressing interview. Also want to talk about this stuff that went on in Paris. We all are just a complete ball of emotion after this. Half of me says go in and bomb. Half of me says, okay, we have to be calculated. I like that France wasted no time and went in and bombed some ISIS strongholds in Syria. What to do? We will discuss that. And we are going to talk to a woman that I can't understand. She went 200 days without buying anything new. I can't even imagine. I get excited when I go pick up the car when it's been in the shop. It might just be the transaction of paying for something. I know it's $500 to get the car fixed, but I enjoy spending my money, and she went 200 days without buying anything new. We will talk to her. Eric Zorn will be in today, noted pet expert Steve Dale later on this afternoon. And we will talk to Judd Surratt about this fantastic team called the Chicago Blackhawks. It's Wendy Snyder at 720. It's WGN. All right, I don't know if you've heard the news, but, you know, I'm so sick of the whole Starbucks flap. But you can now go to Dunkin' Donuts because they have launched a new coffee cup emblazoned with the word joy on it and sprigs of holly in a Christmassy red and green color scheme. This according to the New York Post. All the stuff with Starbucks and the cups, and because of no Christmas things, Starbucks hates Jesus. I don't see that to be the case in any way, shape, or form. But Dunkin' Donuts, in my opinion, way better coffee and much cheaper. And plus, you can get like a really soft donut. Kevin, you're not thinking that it's as good as coffee?
No, and not at all.
It's not as strong, and I think
it's like
that's
water.
What. Yeah, that's what you like. You
yes.
like the jolt.
Exactly.
Dave, do you drink Starbucks coffee?
I drink Starbucks. I've got a cup right here, but I really like Dunkin' Donuts.
See? It's smoother. It's more mellow, and maybe there's not as much caffeine in it, but it's palatable. And now I can celebrate Christmas and get those Christmas donuts. Sometimes they have the Christmas tree-shaped donuts. I'm keeping Christmas alive. In fact, I was told by my soon-to-be 13-year-old son, Dylan, that we are putting up the tree tonight. And I think it's a little
wow.
too early.
Early, huh?
So I said, well, can we maybe wait till Sunday? And then there was a craft fair, and I bought all this Christmas stuff. I'm getting in the Christmas spirit. And Thanksgiving right around the corner. Will you be hosting or going somewhere, Dave?
We host. We host. And I think 17 people.
Wow.
So we do it every year. We do a big. And since my son was a little guy, we've done a turkey bowl, which everybody does. You do a touch football game on Thanksgiving morning, which we've always gone to Dunkin' Donuts and bought the donuts and coffee and hot chocolate for the kids. And the dads and the kids play. And we've had like 60 guys there over
oh
the years.
Oh, my God.
And now, of course, all the kids are all young. I mean, they're all
men.
Some of them, my son's married, you know, they're in their mid-20s. And I'm a little nervous about playing, quite frankly, because some of these guys are big and strong and fast. And so I think some of the dads may just opt out and watch this year.
Yeah, it's weird how things change like
yeah,
that. The little
yeah.
ones become bigger than you.
I don't think they want the hot chocolate anymore. I think they've got other ideas.
Maybe if you put a little schnapps in
yeah,
there,
maybe.
They would enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So did you say flag or touch?
It's touch, but it gets a little rough. We've had some injuries.
You're just like the Kennedys. Don't they get together
yeah,
and play the
exactly.
football?
Exactly. That's exactly the comparison I would make.
I'm hosting, too. I love hosting Thanksgiving. To me, that is the one time that our house gets spotless. Because, you know, when you have the family over, family criticizes you more than friends. So you get the house really clean, and I pride myself on making the best, moistest turkey.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, what time will you sit down to eat?
You know, that is a tough call, because when I was growing up, it was like one or two. That's what
okay.
when we used to have it. But I usually go four or five, because it takes me that long to get everything ready.
Well, we've always gone like kind of five or six. Sometimes halftime of the late football game. But I've talked to a lot of people who this year are moving up their plans because of the Bears-Packers game in the evening.
That is going to be pretty exciting.
And you want to be done with dinner. You want the dishes put away and everything. And
what if it all comes down to the Bears beating the Packers on Thanksgiving Day because Ditka put the Pack jersey on? I mean, really, it could happen. The whole time-space continuum is off.
It is. It is. I mean, that could end up being a very important game. Probably will be, especially if the Bears win this Sunday, which
oh my God.
I think they have a great chance to do. So it could be very interesting.
This
and
is
it's all
be
and the coach gets all the credit.
The
right?
best holiday season ever. I mean, I know the Packers are really good, but we have to be hating on the Pack. We have to.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's in all of our DNA.
So is the plan then to eat the turkey and then get a little nap in? Because that game doesn't start until 7:30, right? It's the later game against the Packers?
It's the later game. It's the 7:30 game. But then you've got the 3 o'clock game or 2:30 game will be going. So,
do you know just the sound of football when it's not the Bears playing is just a nice soundtrack to take a nap on Thanksgiving?
When the tryptophan?
Yeah, when it kicks in.
Kicks in.
Grandma might need to bring some espresso. Keep everyone alive and moving to get to that football game.
Does Dunkin' Donuts serve espresso? Because they have the holiday joy cups, and Rick wants to jump in on this. Hi, Rick.
Hey, I'm glad you brought that point up because 20 years ago, everybody started to drop Merry Christmas because it offended everybody, and you had to say Happy Holidays. And now you've got Starbucks being accused of not saying Merry Christmas. I mean, these special interest groups, they got to go. I personally say Merry Christmas to everybody every year, all the time.
You know how you can make it even better, Rick? You could just always go, Merry Christmas, if it applies. Because I do that on Mother's Day and Father's Day to people. Because some people don't have kids. So you can do right. It, you know, Merry Christmas, if it applies. If not, enjoy your holiday. Or is that
even
still too?
If you notice the Dunkin' Donuts that says joy, it won't say Merry Christmas on it.
Well, I'd rather have joy, wouldn't you? Joy in this land of ours?
I suppose. I find this whole thing with the Starbucks and Merry Christmas, that's what really bothers me. I'm like, first you got to say Happy Holidays. You can't say Merry Christmas. Now they're blaming Starbucks because they're not saying Merry Christmas. It makes no sense to me.
We can't win, can we, Rick?
Nope, we can't.
All right, well, have a good Monday, all right?
Hey, Merry Christmas.
If it applies, which it does, so thank you very much. All right, Bill Leff is off this week. It's Wendy Snyder. We will do some news. It's 7:20. It's WGN. It's the Bill and Wendy Show with no Bill. Steve Bertrand is sitting in his seat today. Thank you for hanging.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Wendy.
Bill is taking the week off, and I want to talk about something real briefly. Many of us are getting to that age when our parents are getting older and they are passing away. I lost my dad when I was 10, and part of his junk in the basement that we had to go through had old-time radios. He had a bunch of old radios that he actually listened to because they were very popular when he was a kid. So I kind of started collecting old radios because of going through his junk.
That's nice.
And it makes me think of him. But now there's a woman we're going to talk to right now who kind of went the other way. Asiya Barrett is with us. Hi, Asiya.
Hi.
Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, Asiya Barrett.
Okay, Asiya Barrett. And your father passed away, and, you know, you never have time to mourn because you have to go through all of his stuff. I have told my husband that if I die before him, good luck finding everything because I have stuff in piles somewhere. The file cabinet, you'd think, but no, there's other stuff in there. And it's really tough and a pain to go through all this stuff. And you realized after your father died that we all accumulate so much crap, basically. Is that how this all started with your experiment?
Yeah, exactly. So my dad passed away. Like, we loved him so much. And he was actually living with me and my husband during the last 8 months of his life. But then he passed away and, you know, we hadn't been to his apartment in, you know, 8 months because he was living with us. And so we knew that we had to clean it out and get everything out of there in time for the end of the lease.
What a daunting task. Because, I mean, really, don't you collect a lot of stuff? And I do not have any great way of filing things.
Yeah, it's not only the papers were really overwhelming and all that. But it wasn't just that. It was just, you know, just everything, like the overall volume of stuff that, you know, we just naturally accumulate over our lives was just really shocking to me. Like, I had no idea that, like, one person could just accumulate so much stuff over their lifetimes. And so for me, it kind of motivated me to try to figure out a different way. Because, you know, it's not only my dad that passed away, like, on that day. Like, many people passed away on that day. And, you know, someone else was going through the same process as I. try to figure out what to do with their loved ones, all their loved ones' stuff, like their clothing, their furniture, their knickknacks. And a lot of it was going to the dump. A lot of it was getting donated. And I just felt like there must be a better way of kind of, you know, living so that we're taking that fact into account, that we're not just, you know, going to be living eternally. Like, we have a limited life and we have a limited amount of resources on this planet. And there is already a ton of stuff already in existence. So I was like, well, I'm sure I could go, you know, a few months. I just chose 200 days arbitrarily, during which I would only buy secondhand things and just kind of live off of the things that kind of are the waste products of the way that we live in a way. So kind of feeding off of the waste in a, so to speak, but really a lot of the stuff is like brand new. So it really wasn't like that.
So not food though. You would buy food.
Well,
yeah, definitely. Groceries. Well, medicine, wait. All that.
She didn't go dumpster diving.
I think I might be able to live 200 days off the food we have in our house.
Really?
Well, I mean, it would get pretty raunchy.
Like the canned
the end,
goods and
yeah,
stuff.
So many, you know, powdered soup mixes that were a good idea once. Or,
I know.
I mean, I wonder how long you could do that. So I'm sorry, I wasn't being smart. I kind of meant that.
And, you know, everybody's upcycling and recycling. And I personally love going to Goodwill and antique stores or junk stores or flea markets, because you really can repurpose a lot of things. So that's what you did for 200 days. And how did it go for you?
It went well. Like, part of it too was that I wanted to get rid of a lot of the stuff that I was holding on to, because I, you know, in the future, I didn't want my loved ones to have to deal with getting rid of, you know, sentimental items that I had kept. So I kind of, the first thing I did during my challenge is that I went through the process of getting rid of the things that I was holding on to for, you know, no good reason. So I got rid of my wedding dress. I got rid of a bunch of awards, and I did. I donated it just because I felt like I was just thinking in my mind, okay, so I keep this dress, you know, maybe one day I'll have a daughter. Like, I don't have kids, but if I do have a daughter, maybe she might be interested in wearing the dress, but she might not be. So I'm just going to keep this dress forever. And then one day, you know, when I die, my kids are going to be left with this old, dusty, yellowing dress. And they're going to be like, oh, okay, can we throw this out? Like, I don't know. Mom kept it all these years. Like, it's just really painful to go through that.
Now, I see.
So I just decided.
Wendy has two sons, and I can tell by the look on her face that she still has her wedding dress.
I do, and I don't know why, because I'm never going to fit into it again. But now my niece just had a daughter, so I have a great niece now. And when she was baptized last weekend, they took the wedding dress and made a little baptismal gown for the baby. So I don't know. Something can be reused with it. I can't let go of that.
Yeah, I think that for some people, for sure, like, I've come to understand that, like, it's not about just getting rid of stuff and just having the least amount of things possible. It's just about being, like, critical and true to yourself about what things in your house, you know, truly give you joy and truly make you happier, or things that you get use out of, versus things that you're just keeping for the sake of it type thing.
How many pens can you use at a time, Wendy? How many pens can you use at once?
One.
How many pens do you think you have in your house?
Hundreds.
Right. I mean, I know I see us talking probably about bigger things, but we have so much.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of something, and Sia, you said something that really touched me. You don't have children now, but if and when you do, you don't want your kids, when you pass away, to find your wedding dress and go, oh, Mom hung on to this for all these years, we can't get rid of it, because then the guilt befalls them. Is there something that you found of your dad's that you had difficulty getting rid of because it was so sentimental to him?
Oh, absolutely. There was tons of stuff. Like, we found old letters, like old reference letters, old, you know, report cards from when he was in university, you know, papers that I was keeping as well before I went through that process. And you just look at those and it really isn't, you just wonder, why did he keep these? Like, why was he holding on to these? And it, for me, caused me a lot of pain, because I was like, why did he have to hold on to these? Like, why couldn't he let these go? But now I realize that, you know, just like everyone, like, he was just trying to hold on to pieces of the past. Like, he was just trying to keep those as memories. But now I've personally changed my perspective on that. And I feel like the past is something you can't really hold on to. Like, it's in the past. So I tend to hold on to, like, if a sentimental object isn't giving me, if I hold it and it's not, like, giving me joy and I'm not, you know, feeling happy or glad that I kept it, then I don't keep it just for the sake of it being a sentimental object.
So I'm thinking, though, but, I mean, did you not get lost in those report cards and going through them? And, you know, I mean, it's not necessarily a negative thing, I think, to sort of, I'm going to say go back, which makes it sound negative, but sort of to learn a little bit more, to get a little more perspective on a life.
I think for me, in a way, for me at least personally, it was just a source of pain for me, because it's like I think it would have been better if we had gone through these things when my dad was living, so we could talk about mm-hmm. it to him and, you know, see what he thought. But after he had passed away, you know, his life is over, like, and, like, you know, we have to, and also, like, it's like, it wasn't just, like, oh, a few sentimental items and we had to kind of go through them. It was, like, a load of stuff. Like, it took us weeks to clear everything out. So not only was it very overwhelming in terms of the volume, but it was just, like, so much, and we had to just deal with it, it was hard. It was like a decision we had to make, like, and it was like so many hard decisions, if you know what I mean, because the volume of stuff was just so, so much. Like, there was just so many quote unquote sentimental items that, you know, I have two little sisters that helped me go through it. And we just were just overwhelmed with, like, all of these, like, heart, you know, like, these heart-wrenching, like, documents and things that, you know, caused us so much regret, that, you know, oh, we wish that we had, you know, talked to him about this. But, you know, it's not, like, when you're living your life with your parent or whatever, like, you're not really focusing, like, you talk to them about their past, but you're not focusing on, you know, papers and, like, you're
right,
living in the moment, like, or as you should be, right? And so it's kind of like it's hard to explain, but for me, just the volume and also just the emotional pain that came with having to deal with that shortly after he had passed away was something that I thought I personally wouldn't want my loved ones to have to go through. So I just...
That's very unselfish of you. That really is, because, you know, boy, my family's going to have a heyday trying to find stuff when I go.
I have my college philosophy textbook in the basement.
See, I save all that stuff too, but now talking to Asiya, I'm thinking, really, why do I need that? And I'm just, before we let you go, I want to ask if there's something, like, when my dad passed away, I was young, and it took us, you know, we kind of just left the basement. It was an unfinished basement. We kind of just left his crap down there. And then as we were going through it, he had a bunch of old radios, which my sister said, do you want? And I said, yes, I do. And now I collect old radios. Is there something that maybe you're going to continue to collect to keep your father alive in memory? Is there anything you found that maybe will become a collection for you because of him?
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, when we first moved his things out, we took, you know, 10 to 15 boxes away, and eventually I threw most of those out. But I've just, you know, and I guess, like, my kind of advice to anyone is not, like, you know, I'm not advising people to just live with nothing and just get rid of all their stuff or whatever. But I just think, for me, like, I'm much more critical about what I'm keeping. So as I said, like, anything that I've kept from my father, I kept his old glasses, I kept his old hat, I kept his old passports. These are things, when I look at them, like, for some reason, it just gives me a lot of joy and happiness to see them. And it has an emotional effect on me. Like, when I hold them in my hands, like, I feel like I remember him better, and I smile because I think of the ways that I saw him using and holding those objects. And that's why I keep things in general. Like, if they
give you a good feeling, yeah. If there's something that makes you sad, you purge. I just want to invite you to my house, Asiya Barrett, because I have so much crap to go through, and maybe you can help me hold things and decide if I feel joy from them. Because I need help.
Yeah, for sure.
You're a blogger, and you've done a great job with this experiment, 200 days without buying anything new. Where can we read your work?
For sure. I'm doing the challenge once again. I blog at green-five.com. I'm doing the challenge again, and a bunch of people are doing it with me. So if anyone listening is interested, just go to the website. You'll see the course that I've made. It's just a free email course, and they can sign up and do their own experiment.
I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it. I'll probably last 2 days.
Excited.
2 days, not 200, but 2 days. Good luck.
I'm sure you can do three. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Asiya Barechi, you can find her at Green, H-I-G-H, GreenHighFive.com. Green, H-I-G-H, 5.com. All written out. Does that make sense? GreenHighFive.com.
Yep. I'm going to go this weekend and read my old college essays that I wrote. Because they're downstairs.
Bring them
too.
On the air. Right. We'll read them on the air.
The old blue books.
Oh, can't wait. Bill's off this week. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Steve Bertrand. It's 720 WGN. All right, Steve Bertrand, Wendy Snyder. We were talking about, I'm not a hoarder, but like I found an old report card from Triton College.
But you do save old calendars.
I do.
Yeah. Okay.
I do. In the pantry, there are a bunch of old Bob Marley calendars. Just, I had these Bob Marley calendars and everything's written on it. And I think, oh, I'm going to look back and think what I did on this. I never look back at them.
I could see that. I have some of my old date books. Right.
But why do we need those?
I like my old phone books, and I don't know where they are now, but I've kept them with the idea that, because that is, it's a glimpse of your life. So you can page through and say, you know, I was calling this person, or who was that girl, or, you know, I like that.
When do you page through them, though?
Cause well, I'm going to do it this weekend. That's all I'm going to do.
Because that's what I mean. I found an old report card from Triton College, and it was pretty good, I will say.
Yeah.
And I just kind of stuck it in an old yearbook from my junior high, and I put it somewhere. I stuffed it in a drawer. I mean, I guess I should get all this stuff and put it in a box and Wendy's history on it and throw it in the attic.
I don't think that's not necessarily dwelling on the past or, you know, living in the past. I love just being reminded of it and going back to better times. Oh, wait, that is it. No. No, but I like sort of, you know, just revisiting it. And
but when do you revisit it? You revisit it when you find it stashed in a drawer.
I know
with your...
that if I threw it away, I would want to revisit it. So that's why I'm keeping it.
I know, but we just need like I'm going to have to get one of those storage places.
Yeah, well, then you are a hoarder, maybe.
I'm not a hoarder. I can walk around my house.
Very few people say they are hoarders.
But I'll save things like pieces of metal because I might be able to reuse it in some way to MacGyver something.
Yeah, that's not weird. No.
All right, we're going to take a break here. I don't save dimes. I will tell you that. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we've got Ryan's news coming up at 720 WGN. It's Wendy Snyder here. It's Steve Bertrand. What are you laughing about?
I'm just happy to be here with you, Wendy. I'm laughing at your producer.
Well, then tell your face that.
What?
Why are you laughing at my producer? Are you guys okay? You seem to bicker quite a bit.
I don't think we do bicker that much. I think
it's all in good fun.
I think you bicker with everyone.
That hurts me a little bit.
I mean, but it's done lovingly, I think. You tease the ones you love.
Right, and I tease you,
you must
too.
Love me. Right. Aha, funny. All right, can we get serious? Because really, all this weekend, I did watch a lot of sports, but I was watching our own Lester Holt, who was in Paris. He did a great job. He was talking with some guy who was in the Bataclan who did get out. They were in the balcony, and they got underneath their seats and they kind of crawled to this exit. And did you see the video of them? There was no ladder or anything, but they were outside the building.
Yes.
Helping one another up into
like
an apartment.
Drain pipes
God. I mean, you do whatever you can to survive. The band that was playing on stage, the Eagles of death metal. I watched the video and it's horrific because they're just jamming and you hear the shots ring out and you can't quite tell their shots really.
Except if you watch the drummer because the drummer goes under his kit.
Well, not.
So it looks like, you know, they said people thought it was drumming, but you could see, you know, if they had a camera on the drummer at the time of some of the explosions or the shooting and he kind of reacted to it.
Because I did see the guitarist stage right, left of the screen as you're watching the video. He hears what is the gunfire, but I mean, if I'm at the Metro, if I'm at some live show and I hear it's so loud, I don't know that I'd go, hey, are those shots? It would be unfathomable. So the guitarist on stage right to the left of your screen, you see him just run backstage. And I feel bad because he wasn't a coward. He was smart. He got off stage. I didn't see the drummer cowering. I didn't mean cowering.
He just kind of took cover.
See, I didn't see that. Maybe that was later. Because I read that he did. But if you watch the video, he's still drumming. I mean, they're finishing up their set.
Right.
And it's just so surreal. I can't even imagine. And then to climb up the outside of buildings. And when Lester Holt interviewed this guy, I knew this was coming. He feels the guilt that other people died and he survived. And I mean, God bless him. He shouldn't feel guilty. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just in Paris a few weeks ago.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know, and actually not too far from that theater. But it's interesting to me how we react. And I mean, it really has hit me hard this weekend, harder than I expected. And, you know, because there were 250 people who died in a Russian jet crash, right? That apparently was bombed by ISIS just a few weeks ago. You know, and none of us felt that so much. It's not unusual at all for there to be bombings in Iraq where 100 people are killed. And, you know, we're not having that reaction like we are with Paris. So
that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I think it's an us versus them sort of thing. You know, I mean, we say, well, that's there. That's the Mideast. That's over there. And just by our shared history, we tend to think of the French as more of us. So I think we, you know, are engaged more when it happened.
But it's a different circumstance. The bombing is terrible on the airplane, and they larger casualties because it was all done at once. But this orchestrated shooting of innocent people going about their everyday lives, having food at a cafe, being at a rock concert.
No, I don't want to argue with you, but I mean, you know,
but you're right.
Russians were tourists going home to their families.
Yeah, you're right. They had
moms and dads and kids and brothers. And, you know, I mean, so, but I think we tend to, when it's in a Western country that we are more familiar with, I think we tend to think we could more likely be those victims too. I don't know.
I just know in my own personal thoughts, and listeners jump in, 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking to Professor Tom Mikaitis from DePaul. He's a terror expert, and we're going to be talking to him at 1:30 this afternoon. But right now, there are a lot of people have questions and comments. In my opinion, the airline disaster and the Russian people who died, I guess what it is I feel there's a risk every time you fly, despite TSA and despite things. This has happened before. And just it's different, in my opinion, for people just going about their business, like the Boston Marathon, too. These are people we're just trying to live our lives and we get taken down. And then these cowards I read at the Bataclan were shooting at a handicapped area where people were in wheelchairs and could not escape. I mean, and then the suicide vests that they put on are so archaic. They're putting nails in there so when it blows up. And I also heard that at the soccer match, the guy, the suicide bomber who was supposed to be there was running late. And I believe only one person, one fatality there or something, but that could have been worse. He didn't get in time to detonate this vest.
Inside the stadium, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing that strikes me, and maybe Tom can answer this afternoon, because I keep hearing about how it's this sophisticated planning and all of that, and I don't quite get that. I mean,
they don't have top-of-the-line weapons. Again, they're putting nails in this homemade suicide vest.
Sure,
I know,
but
it does the trick.
Right, but I mean, as far as, you know, planning and all of that, I mean, what it amounted to was, you know, getting tickets or going into a concert theater or going to a cafe. I mean, anyone can do that at any time. I don't know what the level of sophistication is required there.
All right, 312-981-7200. That's the number to call. You can also text us on that line. John, what do you feel about all this?
Well, I feel awful about it, but I'm wondering if maybe, I'm not a psychologist, but maybe we feel more awful about the situation as opposed to the plane situation, because there's survivors that can account for what actually happened in there. So they can put some perspective and some fear into us just by their accounts. Whereas on the plane crash, there's no one to really talk about what happened.
So no survivors, no one who witnessed it, I guess.
There certainly isn't the video of the aftermath and all. That's a good point. I mean, I still think it's because it's the French and not the Russians, but I mean, that is a very good point. I mean, and, you know, and we didn't see, like, you know, with the Malaysian crash, the grieving relatives waiting at the airports and things like that. But look, there are bombings. There are innocent civilians, children, who are killed all the time in bombings in Iraq too, right? And in Syria.
I know. And in Syria, and we've been
a couple of 100,000 people have been killed.
And they're letting Syrian refugees in. They say one of these people, there was a
maybe
whole...
They think maybe one had come in.
John, thank you so much and for your call.
And when I say all this, I don't mean it in any way, because like I said, I was very affected by it too. I don't mean to diminish it at all.
Oh, I know.
But I think I'm just going to try to be more mindful next time I read a story about 72 people killed at a cafe in Baghdad, that those lives are no different than the lives
absolutely
at a Baghdad or in a cafe in Le Marais.
And I forgot my point here.
It was going to be a really good
one. It was
one,
really
I know.
Good. I don't remember. I'm getting confused because there was something on Facebook, and it's like, you know, the whole not all Muslims are terrorists.
Sure.
But those terrorists were Muslim. And then somebody put something on Facebook saying to say all Muslims are terrorists is to say Ted Nugent represents all musicians or something. I'll get the quote because it's true. I mean, I don't know. I completely lost my point here.
There's a huge Muslim population in not just France, but in Paris. You know, I mean, they were a colonial power. Algeria for years, so many people from Algeria came and lived in France and other, you know, African countries as well. So there is by nature just a huge Muslim population there.
All right, I remembered. The Syrian refugees, we were talking about that they have. I was watching again. Lester Holt did a great job last night. And he said that there was, he threw it to a correspondent in Turkey who said that there was a license or identification, an ID card that had been used somewhere and they checked it when some of the Syrian refugees came in and they found that ID next to one of the bodies.
Yeah. I think they're pretty, I mean, they think one of them came in through Greece.
Yeah.
As a refugee. I mean, they do, but you know, there were eight.
Yes.
And so there's one of eight. Still... So, I mean, so, you know, right away there's going to be, they need to be very careful with the people they're letting in. But again, an overwhelming number of them are.
But how do you check them?
Innocent refugees,
I know.
Right?
And how do you check? Is there a big paper trail behind them to
And
say...
had not this one of eight been there, would the other seven not have carried out the attack? I mean.
I don't know. And three brothers now, I've heard in reports.
Yeah. They're looking for, I think, one that's still. One was in the attack, one is in custody, I believe, and one is being looked for. Ugh. If I remember that correctly.
All right, 312-981-7200. People want to talk about this. Eric Zorn will be coming by at 11:30, and I believe he wants to talk about it too, because really that's all we all talked about and watched this weekend is just the... It makes you scared, and you hate to say the terrorists have won, but if you can't go to a concert or you can't go out to dinner, I mean, who knows what's next? 312-981-7200. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Steve Bertrand at 720 WGN. Weather in the first 5 minutes. Watch Chicago's first weather report at 10 p.m. with Tom Skilling. Weeknights on WGN TV News at 10. It's Wendy Snyder here. Bill Leff is off this week, and Steve Bertrand is sitting in for him. We were talking about the attacks in Paris and some news that is really upsetting to me. Some of these attacks may have been planned using a PlayStation 4, according to reports. The game's console is being increasingly used as a way to chat secretly, and at least one PlayStation 4 was reportedly seized during a huge night of raids across Belgium and France. And they're saying last week Belgium's foreign affairs minister warned that the PlayStation 4 was being increasingly used and was very difficult to track. Now, that is scary. Again, I keep talking about Lester Holt, but I watched this that report that he had last night, and a lot of the ISIS people are going into the poorer communities where there are young, vulnerable, impressionable
sure. I mean,
people.
You go to find people who are unhappy or looking for something better, right?
Yes, and to go through PlayStation 4 and this, you know, thankfully, my son Dylan only has an Xbox One, but who's not to say that they're reaching out in all the game systems? Although I guess PlayStation 4 has an area where it's really hard to monitor.
Are they reaching out for them there, or are they just using that to communicate?
Maybe both. Right. They are using it to communicate for sure, but I know Kevin likes to play video games. I'm in my 50s and play video games. Very early 50s. But still, there are kids for
very
the majority. Some of them. And we were talking about the attack at the Bataclan Music Hall. And I had mentioned that they put the nails in the suicide vests, which to me seems very archaic and antiquated. I know it works when it explodes, the shrapnel goes
sure.
flying. But Phil, you had some thoughts on this?
Yeah, and it's nice to hear Steve voice what I've been thinking all weekend when I hear these talking heads on TV. They're talking what a sophisticated, well-thought-out plot this was. And, you know, it's as simple as possible. They give a bunch of guys explosives. They go to some crowded spot. They say at a determined time, pull the trigger.
Right. They probably hooked it up to their iPhone. When the iPhone beeps and they're all synchronized, that's when you do it.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, the talking heads on TV, you make it sound like this is, you know, they're miles ahead of us in terms of sophistication. They're as simple as possible, and that's the terror point right there.
Well,
they make it very simple.
And that's why we'll ask Tom McTitus about it after 1:30?
Yeah, 1:35.
Because I will say that the talking heads know a lot more about it than we do probably, Phil, right? So, I mean, there must be something we're missing here because it doesn't seem to me to be that hard to plan, and that's what's scary.
Or to thwart, you would think
it would be very hard to thwart. I mean, how you know,
I guess,
it could be anyone, anywhere, anytime.
That's true. Thank you, Phil. We appreciate you calling. And one more call, and then we'll have to take a break. John, your thoughts on this?
Hey, Wendy, how are you?
Good.
I agreed with kind of like what Steve was saying that you know the we don't think so much about the people getting killed in Baghdad as we did the French, but. But my feeling on that, too, is that it's what President Obama said this morning, that these Muslims really need to start stepping. If they're, in fact, saying that, oh, no, we're not terrorists like these other people and jihadists and all that, but why don't they stand up to these people? You know, it's I just don't
aren't
get
they
it.
Scared? Wouldn't you be scared to stand up for them if ISIS has got, like, some kind
I
of...
Suppose, and I suppose it's kind of like the south side of Chicago with this code of silence they always talk about that the people are afraid. But at some point, somebody's got to step up and say enough is enough. And my firm believing is I don't want any more Americans killed over there for this. Let the Saudis get into this. I mean, they have a 500,000-man army, you know, and talk about radicalism. Saudi Arabia is one of the worst. I mean, talk about women who are abused and then this is our big ally? Let these people get involved. Why should we kill more American boys? I just don't get it.
I'm with you, John, and that's what's been going on all weekend in my head. We're all going, you know, God, they should just pull another Nagasaki and bomb over there. That's what some people were suggesting on Facebook. And then you think...
You know what? I hate to say it, and a lot of innocents would be killed, but you know what? This has been going on since the 700s over there. It's never going to change. We could go in there with, like we did in Vietnam, with 700,000 men. It's never going to change. I graduated in 1965. My lottery number was like 324. But in my graduating class of 400 people, over 200 of them were guys, and I lost 17 friends in Vietnam. For what?
I mean,
what did it accomplish?
We're all angry and shocked, and I don't know what the answer is. Thank you so much for calling. I hope you keep listening. 135, we're going to talk to DePaul professor Tom Makaitis. He's a terror expert, because I don't have the answers. And you talk about bombing over in Syria. Had we done that, these people were in Belgium. So how would that have helped this particular attack? I don't know what the answers are. But we're all mad.
Right. Well, we think, and, you know, I don't have the answers, but, you know, bombing kills some people, and it makes a lot of other people, you know, sad and desperate.
I know.
And what happens to those people?
But France wasted no
react, right?
France wasted no time retaliating and bombing some ISIS headquarters or locations in Syria. I kind of like that they reacted right away, like, okay, enough's enough. I feel like we take our time, but do we calculate? I don't know what the answer is. But we've all been kind of talking about all the different things that should or could be done, but I don't know. I don't have the answer. So hopefully Tom Makaitis will shed some light on some of these. We're going to take a quick break. Then it's the 11:30 news. Then we'll talk to the Chicago Tribune's Eric Zorn, the engaging Tribune. I'm not playing this game. He always gives
the
us an
energetic
adjective. No, he gives us his own adjective.
Is it different every time?
Oh, yeah. No. We'll talk to Eric Zorn after the news. It's Steve Bertrand. It's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. It's Wendy Snyder here, 720 WGN, as Kim says. And Bill Leff is off this week. Steve Bertrand is sitting in his place. And Eric Zorn, the engaging Tribune columnist, Eric Zorn, is in the studio with us. I said I wasn't playing along with your game.
And yet you did.
I know.
She
I
can't
don't know
help
what
it.
Happens
she
to me.
You know why? Because I've engaged with her.
Well, here's what happened. Noted pet expert Steve Dale, who's on later this afternoon, by the way. Eric seemed to be a little jealous that Steve Dale had a title, because Bill would always call him the noted pet expert. So Eric wanted some kind of title and adjective and description, and now you've been coming up with your own.
We've been experimenting with them. We haven't quite hit the right one.
Yeah, I don't think one word could do it, Eric.
Right. Well, that's why we try a new one every week. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. I appreciate that.
So. All right. We were talking Paris before you came in, and we mentioned that we'll probably continue talking about Paris, because we all have so many questions and feelings about this whole thing that happened on Friday night.
It's really a terrible thing. The question that I have in my mind is, how do they want us to react? How does ISIS want us to react? And let's make sure that we don't react that way. Because people say, like, oh, this is senseless violence. It's not at all senseless violence. There is definitely a method to this madness. And we have to figure out what that is. That's sort of step one. And not do what they want us to do. And I think one of them is sort of not to treat all Muslims as though they're radicalized people, and to create this, you know, further this division between, you know, our nation and the Islamic world. I mean, I have the feeling that this is part of their game, that it's not, you know, they're not going to win a war by killing 129 people at a time. They're going to win a war in their minds by peeling off great segments of the extremely large Islamic world that's not radicalized.
So they want those of us who are not Muslim to marginalize everyone who is.
I think that's part of it. I think they want to create this rift. I mean, that's how they want to create these spectacular successes, right? I mean, this is how they recruit. One of the things that differentiates ISIS from Al-Qaeda, say, is that ISIS is much better at social media. They're getting kids. Remember, they caught the kids at the at O'Hare getting ready to fly to Syria to join ISIS. I mean, they are out there all the time, much more, you know, modern, contemporary with their social media.
PlayStation
recruiting.
4 was used to. This was just announced that it was used to plan some of it, some correspondence, and perhaps to get some people involved. PlayStation 4 was used because there's a certain chat room or area, not chat room, but a server that is hard to keep track of and monitor. So that's what they're going through. That scares the hell out of me.
Well, what do you think about the idea that our lives, this is going to change our lives, this incident in Paris is going to change our lives, kind of the way 9/11 changed our lives, which is that things, there are still, every day we go through security, even here in the Tribune. You know, I used to be able to walk into Tribune Tower. The people would just, like, walk up to my desk occasionally and say, like, hey, about that column you wrote. And I go, who are you? How did you get in here? Because, you know, we had someone at the front door, but it's like, you know, now you've got to have a card to get in.
I'm fine with that,
no,
aren't you?
But I'm saying, you know, all in, and many of the security measures that we go through at the airport, and now that we're going through at the United Center and other places, those things are all related to 9/11 and its aftermath. I'm wondering what sort of changes might we see here. There was just a video out this morning. ISIS is threatening Washington, D.C. What might they do there? And if they were to effect the same sort of attack there at a concert hall or at restaurants, what sorts of security measures would go in place? And what sort of things would we do? And how can we do those things without profiling and marginalizing people, which you know, purely from a practical standpoint is not going to be the way to do it, because if we increase the number of enemies we have, it's going to be harder and harder to stop them.
So. This is Islamic State warned. This is from Reuters a couple hours ago. Islamic State warned in a new video on Monday today that countries taking part in airstrikes against Syria would suffer the same fate as France and threaten to attack in Washington. The video, which appeared on a site used by Islamic State to post its messages, begins with news footage of the aftermath of Friday's Paris shootings, in which at least 129 people were killed. The message to countries involved in what it called the Crusader campaign was delivered by a man dressed in fatigues and a turban, identified in subtitles as Al-Gharib, the Algerian. Do these ISIS members partake in rock concerts? Do they hate us because we do? I mean, look at what they're targeting. People eating dinner at a cafe in Paris. People at a rock show. I mean, why there?
They hate modernity. They hate pluralism. They hate democracy. I mean, it's not just American values. It's Western values that they hate, although it's not... I don't think they have a goal of changing our values. I think they have a role of, I mean, they're clearly, their stated goal is they want to create the world as an Islamic caliphate. They want to rule the world with their, you know, medieval notions. And, you know, that I don't think that's realistic. I don't think they're going to win this war. But the question that we're all now facing is, okay, how do we get control over this? And how do we not blow it like we did when we sort of ended up creating ISIS in the first place by swaggering into the Middle East and trying to, you know, overthrow dictators.
But Al-Qaeda kind of has taken a hit, and that's where ISIS began to grow. Didn't we do some damage to the Al-Qaeda cells?
Well, we did. I mean, and Al-Qaeda certainly is nothing compared to what ISIS is like now.
I hear Al-Qaeda is scared of ISIS.
Well, they rejected. They were rejecting ISIS and ISIS's leader, and saying these guys are too radical for us. And you know, I think they make a strategic mistake when they shoot down a Russian airliner, when they bomb the instead of bombing Beirut, they kill 40 people, and they go into Paris and kill 129 people. And suddenly, you're going to have basically the capable technological Western world that has a lot of differences. You're going to get them united against you, and that might be the solution here. Is I don't think the United States can go in there and say, okay, we're going to go and topple.
Now you've arrived at where you started in a way. You said, we should not react in the way that they want us to.
I don't think they want us to react by having the. I don't think.
But wouldn't they expect us all to unite and go against them?
I don't know. I don't know how well they play this game of chess, but because you know you've got Obama and Putin huddling yesterday, and these guys don't like each other clearly, but this is one thing I think they can agree on, which is we don't want terrorism in Washington mm-hmm. or Paris or shooting down Russian airliners. And they're all fighting this. They now have a common enemy. That's very clear. I think that they're not thinking, they may not be thinking as many moves ahead as they should, because what, you know, this thing in Paris is going to get them some recruits. This is a great victory for them. Let's be honest. I mean, they shock the world.
Who are the people that are going to be recruited by these people? I mean, I don't understand it. Why would they want to be part of this?
They're people who are besotted with this, you know, extreme fundamentalist form of Islam, that and they are seduced by these messages, and they think like, I can sign up, I can make a difference in the world. I mean those are the people
in whose world.
Well, they're in many cases disaffected or innocent or, you know, naive young people for the most part. People who are willing to die. I mean, think about the level of belief you would have to be willing to strap on a suicide vest and go in and start shooting and killing innocent people and then killing yourself.
So we coming after them, and France, rather, with the airstrikes, it's like we're killing people who are okay with being killed.
Yeah, in the long run, yeah, that's true. I mean, they feel like, you know, the old thing about going to their reward in heaven with all the virgins and so on. I think that's definitely the case. But, you know, the thing is that this was not a particularly sophisticated attack, right? I mean, it was not
sure
something,
didn't seem it.
It wasn't like some elaborate. I mean, it was a bunch of guys with guns and suicide vests.
And a guy going to the soccer game was late, so he was unable to get in the stadium. And
if he had, imagine how many.
Yes.
He had the knapsack full of
nails.
Nails and stuff. I mean, it would have been like the Boston Marathon bombing.
Could you hold your thought? We have to take a quick break. We're talking to the engaging Tribune column. Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune will be back. 312-981-7200 at 720 WGN. And Bill's off this week. It's Wendy Snyder here along with Steve Bertrand and the engaging Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune.
And a little bit of news since the break. Governor Rauner now joining the list of governors saying that the state of Illinois, let me quote from the governor's statement, state of Illinois will temporarily suspend accepting new Syrian refugees and consider all of our legal options pending a full review of our country's acceptance and security processes by Homeland Security.
Now, does the governor of Illinois have any authority over immigration? Because I'd always thought that one of the hallmarks of immigration policy was it was considered a federal matter, which is why you can't have local police officers enforcing immigration laws.
Well, I know Governor Pence is doing something similar in Indiana.
Oh, it's all over the country this morning.
So what is it? So then if there are state programs where Syrian refugees are being assisted, that's the only thing I could think of that he would have any control. I mean,
spending state money on anything anyway. So
well, I mean, if a Syrian immigrant comes in through New York, one's to keep the immigrant from driving into Illinois.
Yes,
I mean,
you're totally right. We don't have state borders like that. But, you know, I do wonder what sort of protocols are in place to screen immigrants who are coming in from Syria. It's not like they've got, you know, paper trail or the documents they have are necessarily authentic and so on. I think
or
it
verifiable.
Is
a, that's the problem,
it,
right?
It, I mean, it is a problem. I mean, you can't deny that this is an issue when you're looking at immigrants of any kind, really, but when you're looking at people who are from this part of the world, and I'm not sure, have they identified the national origin of all these attackers?
Well, I think came in as an immigrant.
Well, but others were French citizens, right? I think.
That's the case. Living in Belgium.
I thought only one was a French citizen, and the others.
I thought they were French nationals living in Belgium. Maybe, but I could be wrong on that.
In any case, it's difficult to know when you have this, you know, refugee crisis. You know, people flooding into Germany, flooding into France from Syria, who are legitimate refugees from the terrible civil war going on there. And do you turn your back on them? Do you send them back? Do you create camps? And does that, and when you do that, does that just radicalize them? You know, we're talking about admitting between, you know, 10 and 100,000, I think, of various offers on the table.
So that's the point we've been talking about, right? If someone's still living there under destitute conditions and then ISIS or someone else comes to them and offers them something better.
Right, and they're saying, look, the West hates you.
Right.
The West
look what the West is
you.
Doing
they,
to you.
And they consider you automatically radicalized. You do that. You know, it is a real puzzle. And I've noticed a lot of sort of impotent stomping and swearing and from all corners about what to do about this. Do we have a plan? People say, well, let's have a no-fly zone over Syria. Well, that's kind of tricky when you've got Russian flights going over there fighting ISIS and backing Assad. I mean, it is a real problem to say, like, oh, there's an easy solution. I've got the idea.
Trump has the idea. He says to bomb the ass out of them. I mean, so think about this now. If Donald Trump was president today,
well, this is what I was thinking: is that when a crisis like this happens, you want somebody who is level-headed.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you don't want someone who's just going to fly off the handle. People were criticizing Obama for being a little bit too cool and a little too professorial in his news conference this morning. I would much rather have someone being cool and professorial than being, let's go bomb them, let's rain the, bring down the fires of hell on them. That's very frightening when you have someone who's just reacting.
Eric and I, as half of the Mincing Rascals podcast, giggle every week about what's going on in the presidential campaign, or at least I giggle. But I think this could be have a big impact on the Republican race for president.
Yep.
Because now it's about something.
This is
much
real.
More
it just got real.
Real,
Donald Trump.
Stuff
and
got real.
Supporters of Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, and whom would you want to have in the Oval Office during a situation like that? And obviously, you know, there's all kinds of partisan considerations, but really, you would want somebody, if you look at the Republican field, you want somebody who has run something, who has dealt with crises. Like,
and who is that person?
Well, you know, I like to think that they're probably governors who are best equipped to do that. I mean, if I'm looking at the Republicans, I'm looking at a John Kasich, I'm looking at a Chris Christie, I'm looking at a Jeb Bush. Someone who you think, like, this person is probably not going to just fly off the handle. It's probably got a good sense of what's true and what's false. You know, that would be my, as if I were looking at the, when I look at the Republican field, that's the kind of candidate I want. And again, on the Democratic side, you know, I think Hillary Clinton has a lot of experience in international affairs. You don't have to like her, you don't have to like everything she's done, but she does know the players and she does have a strategic sense. I mean, that just someone who's just an ideologue is like throwing slogans around. And
I propose a new law, though, from this election forward. You cannot have a member of another family member run for president. There cannot be a connection. It cannot, because then it turns into some kind of dynasty.
So this is all about, this is about Ivanka Trump? Is that what this is about?
She might be very good and she'd be very stylish in the White House. But seriously, I want to propose that law. Who do I talk to?
What about Malia and Sasha and
no,
Michelle?
They've, it's like it shouldn't, it can't be another family member. We have to, that has to become a law.
Okay, well,
who do I talk to?
Well,
where do I go?
Talk to King John Williams. I think he's the guy who runs the world. So
tell him about that on your Mincing Rascals,
will
you? Which you can find on WGNplus.com. He is the engaging Eric Zorn. You can read him in the Tribune. Thank you so much. There really is no answer to any of this. We don't know what to do.
I know, and if there were one, I would have it. So.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then you are doing the Wintrust Business Lunch as well. You're working hard all week.
You know, sitting around.
All right, we'll be back at 720 WGN. All right, it's Wendy Snyder here. Bill Leff is off this week. Well, he's off every day, but he's not physically here. Steve Bertrand is here in his place.
I swear the sign said it was chicken.
Do you see what I mean? There's some consistency to this cafeteria meat.
It's not chicken-like. It's good, though. Like you said, it is good.
But can you identify the meat? It's flaky,
it's chicken,
like
it's just, but
fish.
It is different.
It is really weird. I have not identified the lunch in the cafeteria. Hopefully your cafeteria lunch is better. It's not tasty. It's just unidentifiable, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, but it's I'm upset with them because they've started serving onion rings now.
You like onion rings?
I do. I cannot. Because it's so rare you get an opportunity, right, to have an onion ring. So it's hard to walk by them.
How can you get? First of all, I want to say that I did not leave Friday because I was mad about the whole dime thing.
No, there. What was it then? We thought you were so angry.
All right. But see, people, they need to take us. Well, most of the listeners who listen to Bill and I know that a lot of it's tongue in cheek. Some people take us too literally. I had a scheduled doctor's appointment. I had to miss the second half of the show on Friday. And I just, you guys played it up that I got mad about dimes. Kevin said he got an angry phone call saying that I should be fired because if I have to leave in a huff, I would never do
so
that.
So when you stormed off, it really wasn't.
See, you say that, but you are, you know, you're a journalist, so people believe you.
Right. I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
Well, I'm not asking you to apologize.
I think you are.
But, you know, Facebook is sometimes helpful and Facebook is sometimes crazy. But Facebook really did try to help people find their loved ones in Paris, which is kind of an interesting thing. As terrorists rampaged Paris, messages flooded to people and they wanted to know, did you get out of the city when the gunfire erupted? And Facebook was actually pinging people to find out where they were. It was a safety check, as the feature is called, serves as a special status update in a time of crisis. Facebook unveiled this tool last year, inspired by users' reactions to the 2011 tsunami that rocked Japan, and it was last activated during the Nepal earthquake in April. And I think it's pretty amazing that Facebook helped find loved ones and
right.
Facebook was checking on you to see if you were okay if you were in Paris.
Well, I think that Facebook is what more people share than anything else in the world, right? I mean, there are more people on Facebook than share almost anything else.
Wouldn't that have been great if they had that during 9/11?
Yes.
Because right. Remember when the people put the flyers up, and it's just such a quicker way to find people.
I forgot about that. Facebook wasn't around then, was it?
No.
And MySpace, no one went on it because I think that was around then. Maybe not.
2001? I think MySpace was probably around, but
I'm going back to MySpace. Like I've saved my account. I'm going back to it. Yeah,
will you join me?
You'll be like Bill.
I had the best AOL email. It was skb@aol.com.
SKB?
It was my initials, but I mean, I was very early on it. You don't think that's a great email?
Not as good as mine. Mine was snideremarks@aol.com.
I don't think that's any good at all.
That's awesome.
Okay,
seriously?
Okay, fine. I give. You win.
I thought it was SKB. Here. That is great.
Here, take a dime. Call someone who cares.
It's not a dime anymore. Although I bring up Facebook, and Kim, I don't know if you did this, but I changed my picture
mine. Yeah.
But now I'm reading in Red Eye, and there's a columnist by the name of Matt Lindner who says that social media became downright unbearable as more reports and information happened, people changing their Facebook profile pictures so that they are filtered through the colors of the French flag, tweeting hashtags like #PrayForParis, just so they can feel like they're doing something. I wasn't trying to do something. I was trying to show my support.
Doing something, though.
But that's a positive thing.
I agree.
I don't know why people get so negative. That's what social media is for.
It is.
I didn't do that.
That's because you are not warm and comforting.
You're not warm and fuzzy.
I am warm and fuzzy.
You are, oddly enough.
Yeah, you are.
But see, it's one of those things, like even when the rainbow thing came up, when everyone could get married regardless mm-hmm. of your sexual preference, I put my flag flying high on that one. I put the rainbow flag over my profile picture, and I started a lot of fights with people who didn't agree with it.
Really?
And I didn't mean to. I was just, it's my Facebook page. I can do whatever I want.
See, I never put those filters on because, I don't know how. First of all.
Well, okay, true confessions. Like, I didn't know how to do it when same-sex marriage was approved, and I really wanted to. And now I figured it was much easier this time because it gave you the option, and it let you say, like, how long you wanted it there, and then it'll automatically go away. So they are making it easier for you to do it.
Yeah, for the old folks like us.
Yeah.
I figured it out, but then I didn't know how to get rid of it. And this time I just set it for a day and I thought I'll reevaluate how I feel tomorrow.
I didn't realize that. So even for the gay marriage, they give you the option of doing it?
Yeah. You would just say download the app now. It's not even an app. You just kind of can pick a picture.
So they're choosing what you. So and really it's Facebook saying it in many ways.
No, Facebook is saying if you want to use it.
Right. It's giving you the option. It's a nice option. You don't have to do it.
If you'd like to make your profile with the French.
Sure, but I mean, had
Can I finish a sentence ever with you?
Sure, go ahead.
It just says if you would like to add to your profile picture the colors of the French flag, click here. So you don't have to do it. So how is it Facebook's fault?
Well, had gay marriage lost, would they have allowed you to put a color on? Would they have provided for you a color for...
Probably not, because what would be the point
right.
then?
Why would
there
you
are a lot
to?
Of people who wanted gay marriage to lose.
They'll show solidarity.
So they're picking a side, is
yeah,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, but somebody who didn't want gay marriage wouldn't make their profile picture rainbow.
How can you be so smart and yet not so smart?
I'm just saying they're picking your options, your political options. They're picking them.
They're following what are the trends in the news. That was a big, huge thing where same-sex marriage became legal in all states.
I understand that, but so...
Well, they give you an option, Steve. You have the choice to pick it or not.
I know, but...
He wants... when it was legalized, he wants them to be like an all-black color covering your face to show that you disapprove of it. Is that what you mean? Like you could have the option?
All I'm saying is Facebook was all for gay marriage, apparently, as am I, so that's not the issue, but... But they're picking, they're not saying, and if you really hate this ruling, here's what you can filter your face through.
If you hate the ruling, chances are you probably didn't put it on.
Well, and things stayed the same. So what is there to change? Like nothing is changing because it's staying the same.
You don't see what I'm saying at all?
Well, I do, I mean.
So there should have been two options, for or
option
against.
For an ISIS flag too? I mean, is that what you're saying?
All I'm saying is that that all the filters we're choosing are ones that agree that Facebook agrees to. That's all I'm saying.
Well, right. I mean, and if you don't like that, then just go off Facebook, I guess.
It's not a big thing.
Kevin, quit laughing because you're being a contrarian just for the point of being
a
contrarian.
No, I am not. I'm not at all. I mean, I'm all, No, you don't see what I'm saying?
Yes, there should be two. When, for instance, gay marriage, when same-sex marriage came to be legal in all states, if you wanted to support it, you could choose the rainbow flag, and there maybe should have been another option going, I'm not happy with this decision.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, right, so it's Facebook is deciding. Well, I mean, it's Facebook, so they get to decide. I'm just saying they're offering filters that apparently agree with their political viewpoint.
It's no different than the like button, Steve. You can only like something. You can't really unlike it. You know, it's no different.
They pick the available options. Will Facebook filter my picture with an ISIS flag? And here's someone in Steve's defense, and I don't know how you texted this while you were on the air with us, but it says, Steve Bertrand is a genius, and he's just saying that they are offering you your beliefs in a platter to choose yes or no. Chillax, Steve rules.
Thank you, Mom.
Your mom is very hip.
Yeah, I love it when she says chillax.
Is she going to take a chillcation, too?
At the Hilton.
I follow what Steve is saying. I kind of agree with him. It's okay, Steve. The rest of the audience understands you. I do understand it, but what would the option, like, give no option then?
No, I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. All I'm saying is just be mindful of the fact that the filters they're allowing you to choose are... they're choosing them. That's all. They're picking them. I thought when I was seeing all those faces that someone was going to some third party and doing it. I didn't realize it was a Facebook option.
But when you choose to do your news and which story comes first, it's not necessarily which story you like best. It's just that's what's in the news today.
True. That's a good point. So Facebook is, right. They're
topical.
Right. So they
trending.
know what's going to be big and they're feeding what's going to be big. That's
right.
Very good point.
All right. I'm sorry I brought that up. I just tried to put the Paris or the French flag over my face. And now there's a guy in Red Eye whose name is Matt Lindner who says, I need to do more. Do you want to know what he suggests doing? Should we take a quick break? And this is how you can help more than the hashtag pray for Paris and changing your profile picture with the French flag over it.
Sure.
You look shell-shocked now.
I just was trying to raise a point.
Well, you raised it.
Okay.
All right. It's Steve Bertrand and for Bill Left.
I'll be
hopefully
over here.
He'll be back tomorrow. Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. It's Wendy Snyder here along with Steve Bertrand, and Bill is taking the week off. Was talking about an article in the Red Eye today from Matt Lindner, who was saying that Facebook and Twitter had been awash with... while noble, ultimately empty things that people were doing, changing their Facebook profile pictures so that they're filtered through the colors of the French flag and tweeting hashtags like hashtag pray for Paris, just so they can feel like they're doing something. How about this? Instead of changing your Facebook picture or composing a pithy tweet, you honor the victims of Paris massacre and countless other atrocities by actually doing something that benefits society. Donate a bar tab. Anywhere between $50 to $100 to charity. Get involved in your community. Do something for somebody else that benefits them and only them. Do something that affects a positive change in the world. Changing your Facebook profile picture so it has the colors of the French flag might make you feel good, but what does it do? Does it make you a better person? More importantly, is the world a better place because you did it? Is he looking too much into this?
So he's just trying to make me look cheerful, I think.
Well, Steve, you know, and then I diluted the water by bringing up when same-sex marriage was legalized in all states, Facebook offered you an option to put the rainbow flag over your profile picture. Mm-hmm. You didn't know how to do it. And
yeah,
you don't,
I just wouldn't do it anyway. I just...
Well, it did, you know, people who didn't agree then would be angry at me because I did it.
Right.
But it's my Facebook page, and I got to start deleting people. Really, if Facebook is meant to show pictures of what you've had for dinner, if you've made a lovely cocktail, perhaps your dog is wearing a cute little fall-like bandana, that's what Facebook's supposed to be. Tackling issues? Not everybody has one of these. And not everybody should have one of these. And I'm talking to about a microphone.
So what are you saying? I don't get it.
I'm just saying if people were offended because I put the same-sex marriage flag, and then I would delete them. It's Facebook's supposed to be for fun. So you brought up that Facebook then is kind of making your decision for you by, I know what you mean. Explain it yourself.
Well, all I was saying, and in this case, I really agree. I don't disagree with any of them. I'm just saying that when they provide those filters, they are by and large, providing filters for issues that they agree with. Like, who wouldn't agree with expressing sympathy for France?
Right.
When it comes to gay marriage, you know, the flag, you know, most people would agree with expressing appreciation for that ruling, but others wouldn't. But Facebook, now maybe someone texted that Facebook did offer an anti-gay marriage
They
filter.
Did just text that. Yeah. Did you see it? Because I didn't see the option.
Right.
Other than don't use it. But, you know, someone else has just texted Bertrand for president. Would you tell your mom to quit texting?
You know, once she gets the redial thing
down,
you can't stop her.
Sue, you agree with Steve. And, you know, Kim and I kind of jumped on him, I think, but with good reason.
I do. You were beating him up. You were beating him up. And he's right that Facebook does kind of urge you to go a certain direction. I mean, but it's just one big data point that they're collecting in the glams of digital breadcrumbs that they're gathering about us, and they're going to put all of us in some spreadsheet, all of our clicks and likes, and, you know, do something sinister.
Although they did come in handy during the massacre in Paris, where they were trying to find out people that their location was in Paris. They were trying to make sure they were okay. So they did do some things, and Kim mentioned that if Facebook had been up and operational when 9/11 happened, it really would have helped people locate their loved ones that they couldn't find.
Of course they did it. It's to their benefit to identify more Facebook users and get them to understand the benefits
See,
of Facebook. This,
oh, you are cynical, woman.
This is my reward.
My goodness.
This, yeah.
She's on your side,
I know,
Steve.
Yeah. All right, you're on my team, Sue. I guess
and
I'll,
I understand.
I'm going to put you in right field, but you can play.
I know people are skeptical.
Okay.
You
Thank
know,
you, Sue.
But sometimes they do a nice service,
yeah.
Or they do a nice thing. You know,
I'm not skeptical at all. I'm sorry that I'm making it sound like that. I just never thought that they were the ones choosing the filters. That's all.
Oh, you thought it was like
your
own individuals doing.
Yeah, I did.
All right, Casey, why don't you put this to bed?
Hi, I do agree with Steve, but what I think Steve is saying can only be done after the fact. You know, something had to happen in Paris in order for this to happen. How do you know ahead of time in order to disagree with it or whatever? Everything that happened is always after the fact.
So that's why the flag came up, the French flag came up.
Sure.
And that's why the rainbow flag came up when same-sex marriage was legalized.
That's right. That had to happen first in order for this to happen. So the way that Steve's looking at it is correct, but it always has to happen after the fact.
So you're saying they wouldn't have offered the rainbow flag before the ruling?
Well, right. Why would they? I mean, that would be like you saying, you know, well, give me a Greek flag now because something might happen in Greece tomorrow.
Somebody
you
wants
won't
to
know that until it happens.
Well, somebody, Casey, wants to know why no one at Facebook put up a Russian flag when that plane bomb
but you're
happened.
Right, too, because what you said was, you know, they're feeding the beast. They're feeding what people
What's
want.
What's trending?
What they know what people want, right? And like we said earlier, people did not associate themselves with the Russian crash the way they did with the French
True.
Shootings.
All right. Well, Casey, thank you very much. And then one
I'm
other
I'm going to put
text.
Casey in center field. He's on my team, too.
773. I adore when Steve is on because simply he rocks, and I enjoy hearing his opinions and thoughts. Wendy, please stop talking for once and listen.
Well, I think that was my Aunt Donna.
Good God. All right. Well, I'll stop talking. Actually, no, I won't, because that's what I do for a living. So that would be I would not be working hard enough if that happened. We will be talking to Tom Mikaitis, though. He's a professor at DePaul and a terrorism expert, because we have so many questions about this Paris massacre that go far beyond Facebook flags that you can put on your profile picture. So there you have it. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Steve Bertrand. It's 720 WGN. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Steve Bertrand in for Bill Leff. And I don't even know where to begin with this. We touched on this on the first half of our show today. And what's going on in Paris, what happened on Friday, has puzzled us. We all have opinions. We need to find out more. So we bring in an expert, a terrorism expert and professor of history at DePaul University, Tom Mikaitis. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
All right. I don't know where to begin. Steve, where shall we start with the whole Parisian tragedy?
Tom, here's my thing. And we brought this up earlier, but people keep talking about how this was such a sophisticated attack. And when I hear that, I don't understand, because to me it seems like it was a very simple thing that anyone might do at any time.
Well, what they mean by sophisticated is that it was very well thought out. Planning probably went back as far as September. They had coordinated, you know, carrying out, we saw it with the Tsarnaev brothers, to just go and bomb someplace. That isn't that complicated. To pull off near simultaneous attacks at high value targets in a manner that is paralyzes a city does take a little bit more. But you're right, it's not as difficult as people may seem. It took eight people. They had to have good security. They had to preposition weapons. They had to have a good bomb maker. You know, that took some coordination. But the disconcerting thing is that it's a pretty low-tech operation, and that's what we're finding out we're increasingly vulnerable to.
All right, and here's what we know. Three teams of terrorists staged coordinated attacks at six locations throughout Paris late Friday, including the concert hall, restaurants, at least two restaurants, the Stadium of France or Stade de France, and at least 352 people were wounded in the attacks, 99 of them seriously. Is it 129 people are dead? Seven terrorists were killed, one fewer than ISIS said were involved when they claimed responsibility. And then we still have that one Belgian member who is on the loose at this point, correct?
Well, yes, there is one on the loose. They actually captured the third French brother. So they've captured two people, and that's really a good sign, you know, a good thing that they may be able to get much more information as to how this transpired. But, you know, this is not new, and this is, I think, one of my big frustrations. I've been talking about this since 2008 when a team of 10, you know, Pakistani Lashkar-e-Taiba terrorists went into Mumbai, India, and conducted a series of coordinated attacks there that killed about 160-plus people. So, you know, this is the new face of terrorism. Not nearly as new as we think, but this is because it's so much easier to do. I said at the time of the Boston bombings, we were really fortunate that they were as amateurish as they were, that they didn't use light automatic weapons with extra clips and you know, grenade-style weapons. They made these rather poorly designed, you know, still lethal, but not nearly as much as they could have been, you know, pressure cooker bombs.
What about retaliation for, was it Jihad John or Jihadi John that was killed several days ago? You're saying that these attacks were planned maybe as early as September.
Yeah, and the fact that they hit a stadium suggests that, you know, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, they were in the works. Could they have pulled the trigger on them a little earlier to make a point? Yeah, we don't know. I'm beginning to think it's more likely that they, you know, this was already planned for this time. But the thing that's really interesting here is that as much as people are reeling from this, I think in some ways these series of attacks are a sign that the pressure we're bringing to bear on them in the Middle East is actually working, because they're lashing out, trying to get their enemies to back off. They hit the Turks a couple of weeks ago. They blew up the Russian airline. I mean, everybody but the Egyptians admit that it was a terrorist bomb over Sinai right after Russia steps up its pressure against them. People don't realize the Beirut bombing, Hezbollah, which is a Shia, you know, organization, has been going over the border into Syria fighting ISIS almost from the beginning of this thing. So what do? They bomb them. Then France has stepped up its attacks, not just since the Charlie Hebdo bombings in January, but again in September. They increased their pressure. Lo and behold, they hit France. Now we have a video threatening Washington, D.C. So they're hitting at the far abroad because they're beginning to be squeezed at home. And I think that's, strange as that may seem, that's the one positive sign here.
How much of the fact that it happened in France is domestic as compared to international? I mean, you know, it seems as if France is unique in some ways when it comes to their Muslim population, and that some of this has to do with interior politics as well. Is that fair?
That is a fair statement. It's a complex thing. It's important to say, though, that you'll hear, you know, pundits on the far left saying, oh, well, you know, look what they did deserve it. Nobody deserves this. That's ridiculous. But on the other hand, they have the largest Muslim population in Europe. This is a aggressively secular culture, which has created a lot of tensions. This whole thing over whether you can wear the hijab in public buildings or schools and so on, you may recall that, the headscarf and whatever.
Sure, sure.
And, European states are ethnically constructed, so, you know, assimilation is problematic. Not that we haven't had our own issues with that. So, yeah, there is an internal dynamic. And then the other thing is the large number of French men have gone to Syria, gotten trained because they hold French passports. Some of them have come back. So what you have here is something of a domestic international kind of nexus that was, you know, that was triggered in this particular incident. And, you know, obviously that's disconcerting. And sadly, it's going to have terrible blowback. I mean, Marie Le Pen's National Front right-wing party is going to use this as grist for their mill. And the very delicate negotiations over what to do with Syrian refugees are even more dicey now, because one of the terrorists that was killed had a Syrian passport and supposedly came into the European Union through Greece.
And now we have governors in this country sort of falling over themselves to say that they're not going to allow any Syrian refugees into each of his, or I don't know, perhaps there's a female governor to her states. And I don't understand that. What control does Governor Rauner have over whether a refugee crosses the border and comes into Illinois?
Absolutely none. This is political posturing. That's all that is. Look, I'll tell you the one area of concern with refugees that you have, we have two, but one, in terms of, you want to worry very much about the unaccompanied young men. Large numbers of them are unaccompanied young men. Those are the ones that are most problematic. Bringing in refugee families, many of whom, by the way, are fleeing ISIS. It's not like they love these guys. Is a problem. The other thing to keep in mind, you want to produce more recruits for ISIS, be really xenophobic when they arrive. If they face discrimination and prejudice, they're already traumatized, that makes them much more vulnerable to recruitment. So, you know, it's very popular. This is an election year. I mean, the pundits are, you know, hitting the bully pulpits about this is bad, that's bad, we got to seal our borders. Well, first of all, not talking about taking in that many, and second of all, that would send a bad message. These people are already victims.
We have Tom Mikaitis on the line with us, professor of history at DePaul University and terrorism expert. You mentioned the young people and someone, a lot of young men that are not connected to anyone. There have been reports that PlayStation 4 has been used in some of the planning and communication and perhaps recruiting. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, I think you probably, a year or so ago, someone in ISIS developed a jihadi recruiting kind of game video based on Grand Theft Auto. I haven't seen it, but, you know, it's so easy to communicate and plan. I mean, in a globally interconnected and complex world in which we live, social media. I do quite a bit of work on this when I do counterterrorism education in various places around the world. We talk about social media. It's a force multiplier. It aids in this. But as we're seeing in the Paris example, there is always going to be a human contact. People don't log on and instantly radicalize. They've got to be handled. They've got to be connected. They've got to, you know, yeah, you have your lone wolves, but most of those in the United States, we've caught the young man from Bolingbrook and so on. It's these networked, connected, highly trained individuals are the ones that are most worrisome.
Okay, listeners, if you have questions, 312-981-7200. We've got the guy for you. He's an author, several books on terrorism expert, professor of history at DePaul. And 312-981-7200 is the number to call. Tom, you okay on time?
I'm fine with time, too. I also have a blog if you don't want to write about all this stuff. It's tmckite@wordpress.com, but yeah, I've got plenty of time.
Okay, hang on, and we'll get that website and put it out there again. And 312-981-7200, you can get in via phone line or text, because we all have so many questions about what's going on, what happened, rather, in Paris and the after effects. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Steve Bertrand, 720 WGN. All right, Bill's off this week, and what a good week to be gone, because really I can't stop thinking and talking about what happened in Paris, and I know you are all with us on that. 312-981-7200, we're talking to professor of history at DePaul, terrorism expert, author, his name is Tom Mikaitis, and what is your blog again, Tom?
I'm going to give you the exact number. It is, tmckite.wordpress.com. And I also have a Twitter, which is @DrMikaitis.
Okay. And tmckite, spell that, because it can be taken many different
ways. TMOCKAIT.wordpress.com.
Okay. All right. We will put a link up on our Facebook page, Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder, because you're really fascinating to talk to about this. And we have calls. We have listeners that want to talk about what's going on in Paris and what happened in the retaliation, which before we get to that, real quickly, you mentioned the video that came out earlier today saying that, you know, first of all, France was very quick to retaliate doing some airstrikes against some ISIS strongholds in Syria. And now a video comes out earlier today saying that anyone who cooperates and joins in will be in trouble, and they're targeting Washington, D.C. How do we believe this?
Well, they're always targeting us. I think there is an increased likelihood of an attack. We're the only one in the coalition that's gone after them and hasn't been hit, with the exception of the British. On the other hand, this isn't going to deter anybody. Believe me, those strikes by the French, that's a calling card. That's just the beginning. ISIS has bought a world of hurt, because I think if you look at what's going on at the G20, I think we're even reaching a tacit understanding with the Russians that you're going to see increased coordinated attacks against ISIS. And they're already talking about invoking Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, NATO's founding document, which we used after 9/11, and our allies, including France, backed us to say, this is an act of war. Attack one of us, you've attacked us all.
All right, let's get to these calls here, because listeners have questions. We all do. And Bill is on the line. Bill, Tom Mikaitis.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Professor. Fox Business reported today that there's a report that came out today saying that there's already 71 ISIS recruits in the states that have already signed up for missions. Do you know anything about that? And they've listed
it's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard to get precise intelligence on that. The best estimates we have is between 1 and 200 people have gone to join ISIS. How many have come back, we don't really know, because ISIS's recruitment patterns using social media and various other things are also to tell people, hey, you can strike a blow in the country, you can stay where you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's plausible. I really question how they, you know, that's any more than an educated guess. Because I don't know where that, without an identification of what their intelligence source is, I would view that with a healthy bit of skepticism. On the other hand, we're a free, open society. It's just not that hard to come and go. And it's very easy to get weapons here. I'm not making a statement on that one way or the other, but, you know, pulling off a peristyle and attack in some ways would even be easier in the United States than it would be in other places.
Bill, thank you for calling. We're going to try and get to most of your calls. And here we have Tom. Hi, Tom.
Tom, yes, Professor, can you tell me how many civilian casualties occur when we or the French or any of the other people that are bombing the various peoples in the Mideast, how many civilian casualties are those? This is war. The punks that attack the Paris people, we see as punks. They see them as warriors. When we drop bombs, what happens to civilians there, and what's different about that than what these punks in France did?
Well, the same thing that happens when you drop bombs in conventional war. There's this kind of naive notion that, you know, conventional wars are clean and unconventional ones are dirty. I mean, 47 million Europeans died in World War II. Most were civilians. Yes, civilians died, especially when ISIS is perfectly willing to use them as human shields. They will, in fact, they don't mind hiding in mosques, hospitals, schools, civilian neighborhoods, precisely to create the collateral damage. We try as hard as we can to engage in pinprick strikes, like we did when we got Jihadi John. And the key there is, he was a bad guy, he's gone. But the real key is we had good intelligence on that. A lot die. I don't know how many. I don't know that we know how many, because in these wars, determining who is and is not a civilian is by no means an easy thing. We've lost a number of our soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq because they held fire thinking that someone approaching them was a civilian and turned out not to be. So, you know, it's a tough question. I think we try hard to minimize civilian casualties, but I'm afraid it's unavoidable.
Thank you, Tom. War is not pretty. It isn't. And
there is a difference. There is something you asked about the comparison. the way that we do this, civilians die, but we try very hard not to target them. I mean, the viciousness of the Paris attack is so bad that The Guardian was reporting that one of the shooters at least went into the disabled section.
I know, people in wheelchairs.
Because they couldn't get away and they shot them. Now, you know, how much more of a testament to the barbarism do you need? We don't do that. You know, whatever else you want to say, however well you want to critically want to be, we don't deliberately target people in that manner. They do. There's no. If you're not one of them, you're not. You're not human in their regard.
I want to ask Tom another question. Jeb Bush is sort of taking his lumps today, and I don't think it's altogether fair. He apparently said something to the effect that, you know, we need to find a safe haven for the Syrian refugees in Syria. But then he said, but we need to bring the Christians out. And, you know, people are jumping on that. But I think what he's talking about is this very specific Yazidi Christian population that has been absolutely slaughtered by just about every side, correct?
Not every side, actually. The Yazidis have lived in Iraq peacefully for centuries. It's ISIS that has attacked them. It's important to remember, though, the vast majority of victims of ISIS are other Muslims. This is a civil war. I wrote this in one of the pieces on the blog page I talked to you about. Civil war within Islam. This is a fight between Sunni and Shia. It's also a fight between moderate and radical Sunni, and that has to be kept in mind. The safe area in Syria, to me, is a formula for disaster. That's what happened in Srebrenica. You create a safe area, but they also want to use it as a staging area for anti-ISIS fighters. That means you congregate refugees in a place that is going to get targeted. That's not a particularly good solution. You know, again, I can't say it strongly enough. This is not something unique and inherent to Islam. We can't forget what happened in Charleston a couple months ago. You know, every religion on the planet is capable of perversion into this kind of violent activity.
All right. This is so fascinating, and I apologize to some of the listeners. Don, Stan, we did not have time to get you on the air. You can check out his blog. I'm on it right now. It is TMOCKAIT, TomMcKite.wordpress.com. We'll put a link up at our page, Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder. Tom McKite is professor of history at DePaul, terrorism expert, author of many, many books. Thank you so much. It's nice to talk to you terribly under these circumstances, but we learn a lot more when we have you on the air.
Thank you. I'll be happy to help anytime. Have a nice day.
You as well. Really, he helps make me feel a little better, like they're panicking because we are weakening the ISIS cells. That's what I'm hoping, and they're acting out of desperation. I hope that to be true.
I hope he's right.
All right, so we'll take a quick break. We have news coming up. We're going to talk to Judd Surratt. What a great weekend for Blackhawks games. It was really fantastic. Duncan Keith is back and cuter than ever, may I say.
I think so too, Wendy.
And who else is cuter than ever? Noted pet expert Steve Dale. He will be coming up later on as well. And Bill's off this week, enjoying some time off. Not sure what he's doing. Probably buying some new toys.
Painting the house.
He doesn't do that. Steve's in his place. It's Wendy Snyder, Steve Bertrand, 720 WGN. Woo! I have turned into the most rabid Blackhawks fan ever. Steve, what about you?
I love the Blackhawks.
Well, Judd Surratt is on the line with us. And Judd, I don't know what has happened to me, but I have taken to tweeting all the excitement of all of the Hawks games. And I'll tell you, this was a pretty darned exciting weekend.
What are you doing, trying to take my job?
Maybe.
No, it was incredible. You know, it was a much-needed weekend for these guys. Heading into the weekend against St. Louis and Calgary, Joel Quenneville was asked, what's your level of concern? And he says it's high. Because remember, heading into the weekend, I think the Blackhawks were a game over 500. And the other thing you have to remember is, while the record is somewhat similar, in fact, the record they have right now heading into the Circus road trip is exactly what it was last year. But the difference is that the division is so much better and it's so much more competitive that they need to make up some ground and they need to make it up now. And I don't think there's any question they probably put together six of their best periods all season on Saturday and Sunday.
I got to tell you, Saturday night was one of the most exciting Blackhawks games I have ever seen. It was the Blackhawks seemed more like themselves having Duncan Keith back on the ice with them.
And Michael Roosevelt.
Yes,
I think
number
having
32.
The experience of those guys is something that you just cannot overstate how important it is to the team. But on Saturday, I agree with you, Wendy, that was an awesome game. You know, there's been talk around the National Hockey League, just in the bigger picture, that Mike Babcock, the head coach of the Maple Leafs, said, well, we need bigger nets because we need more scoring. There's a lot of talk about diminishing the size of the goaltending equipment, which I actually think is going to happen. But I think what fans want and what you got out of Saturday night's game was you got action. You got physicality. You got intensity. You got emotion. You saw the captain drop in the gloves. You saw some great saves.
He's been doing that a lot lately.
What's that?
Captain Sirius has been dropping the gloves a lot lately.
No, I know. I was joking with Brandon Bolick, who did that a lot for the Blackhawks when he was here, and he was in town for Calgary yesterday, and I was joking with him in the dressing room after the morning skate. I said, are you ready for Taves night? He said, I've been watching. Unbelievable. He's tied with me this year, dropping the gloves a couple of times. But I think some of that is organic and spur of the moment. In the last one, since you mentioned David Backes,
He
a suspect hit on Nicholas Hjalmarsson, one of the team's core defensemen, and Jonathan was right there and immediately stepped into the fray. I think it was maybe about a week ago in New Jersey where the team started sluggishly. They were down 3-0 in the first period. Adam Henrique was giving him a couple of chops in the back, and so Jonathan, I think at that point that drew his ire, and he wanted to try and spark his team at that point. I don't think that you want to see him do it, but it's certainly it's infectious, and it just grows the type of leader that he is for that team. Even Bolick had mentioned, when you see a guy of that stature dropping the gloves, because he, you know, potentially puts his team and puts him his team in peril when he does that, because you don't know what can happen in those instances. But I think that if you're a role player, anybody else on the team, I think that you just want to raise the level of your game to where his is at.
All right, and so Marian Hossa really belted one in. I knew that was coming. I felt it coming for a while. And Patrick Kane, 13 games in a row, he is on fire.
I've never seen him hotter than he is right now. And I think, what does he have, goals in 7 straight games at this point? He's leading the National Hockey League in goals and points. And I don't even think it's possible, but he's actually had the puck even more this year. And Joel Quenneville termed it, he's been a force when he's been on the ice. He's been incredibly consistent, almost picked up basically where he was last year, Wendy, when, if you remember, before he busted his collarbone, he could have not only led the league in points, but he was certainly a serious candidate for the MVP in the league. And I think, you know, he's right there again. I think he's been even better. The other thing that's amazing is his plus-minus. He is leading the league in plus-minus, which is usually an indicator of what type of impact you have on a game at even strength, 5-on-5 or 4-on-4. And when he's on the ice, good things have happened to the Blackhawks a lot.
And he's not selfish. I mean, he and Artemi Panarin are really such a nice little team right now. Brandon Saad, who?
Well, Artem Anisimov, since you bring him up, and he was one of the guys that came the other way in that deal in Columbus, along with Marco Dano. Artem, at this point, has equaled his goal output from all of last year. He had 7 last season with Columbus. He's already got that at this point. He's playing the middle, and he's so valuable in a variety of situations, a lot like Brandon Staud was for this team, even though he was playing on the wing, but he killed a lot of penalties as well, and Anisimov can do that. But it's so funny, when you think about Panarin and Kane, in a lot of ways, they are identical players. They're just different hands. Panarin is right-handed, and Patrick Kane is left-handed, but they play the game so similarly. They dog the puck. They're able to beat guys one-on-one. They have this ability to see where everybody is on the ice at all times. They move well, and they have an understanding of where the other guy is going to be and how to open up the ice. That dish that Patrick Kane made to Artemi Panarin last night was simply spectacular. I don't think that there are many guys in the league that can make what's called a saucer pass, where they elevate the puck flat and then lift it over a stick or two or maybe a leg and then have it land flat for Panarin right over at the far post, and he banged it home. He actually had some time to take his time and pick his spot before rifling it in. There are not many guys in the league. I don't know if anybody can make that pass other than Kane.
And Scott Darling doing a dynamite job. It was tough, but he kept a lot. He slammed the door shut on a bunch of goals.
Well, that was good. That was encouraging because I think Scotty had gotten off to kind of a bumpy start. His first outing was really good. And then the next couple were not great. He didn't have such a great outing in Minnesota. I remember, I think he said, listen, the team scored five goals. I've got to be able to get us a win in that instance. But you could see better performances starting to build from Darling. It may have gone unnoticed, but when Corey Crawford got yanked in the game against the New Jersey Devils when they were playing at The Rock in New Jersey, that Darling went in, and the last two periods, he was terrific. And I think he was able to build on that performance last night against the Calgary Flames, and that will be so important because you've got some back-to-back situations that are going to come up here on the Circus road trip where basically you're going to play, Wednesday, day off on Thursday, and then Friday, Saturday. You're going to do the identical thing. You're going to do the first week, basically, and the first leg of the trip through Canada. And then the second part of the trip will be through California. You're going to need Scott Darling in those instances. And where the Blackhawks are at, they need every single point possible to get back into the playoff chase in the Western Conference.
Well, back-to-back games on Saturday was so exciting, and that took all their effort, and then they came back and did it again Sunday night. Tomorrow night is the next game, right?
Wednesday.
Right.
Unless there's a game I'm unaware of.
No, I'm just so excited.
That game. Listen, if you're live tweeting about the games, Wendy, why don't you just host? Bring it on.
No.
You just, and Troy Murray?
No.
You and the Muzz?
I'm not doing it. You do a great job, but it's...
No. Come on, Wendy.
I'm so excited. A year ago, I didn't even know what the circus tour was, and now I know what top shelf means and slamming the door shut. I'm really having fun watching these games and tweeting at Wendy Snyder. So, Judd, you've inspired me.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think it's the team. And watching some of these guys play, listen, it's a treat watching Kane and Panarin and some of these guys dangle on the ice. Hopefully they're able to continue to put this together because, you know, they've got some other tools out there between Hossa and Taves. I still think we haven't seen the best of Teravainen. Seeing Duncan Keith back in the lineup, hopefully if these guys can continue to string things together, the Blackhawks can put together a run and maybe make themselves or put themselves back into the playoffs. That's their goal. And just getting into the playoffs this year is going to be a feat.
Aren't we about even with last year's record right about now?
Identical.
Okay,
identical.
Look at that.
We went on a serious run. But the thing is, though, Wendy, when you look back at last year, you had some teams that weren't playing as well as they are now. Dallas was a team that made some serious changes during the offseason because they didn't make the playoffs, and they acquire Patrick Sharp, and they signed Johnny Oduya, and all of a sudden you have seen them play exceptionally well. Right now they're the best team in the Western Conference, at least as far as points are concerned. The Winnipeg Jets are a better team than they were a year ago. I think they're going through kind of a slump at this point, and the Blackhawks just jumped over the top of them in the standings, but they've added some skill to their lineup. They've got a kid named Nikolai Ehlers, who you're going to get a chance to see here at the United Center the next time that the Blackhawks are up in Winnipeg. But he's an exciting player, and he's a candidate for Rookie of the Year in the National Hockey League. But those are a couple of teams that are better than they were last year. And Troy and I have talked about this in the past, that the way the playoffs are structured in the National Hockey League, it is probably going to be five teams coming out of the Central Division representing the Western Conference again. So if you're the Blackhawks, and if you look at all the teams in the Central Division, and there are seven teams, six of them are really strong. Colorado's gotten off to a really slow start. There's going to be a good team in that division that is not going to make the playoffs. The question is, who is that going to be? Because it's probably going to take points in the high 90s in order to get into the playoffs.
All right, and how many stitches does Siebes have?
I don't know. We'll see him tomorrow. That looked kind of messy.
Puck in the face.
I think he took it like right on the forehead. And you could see, I'm sure you saw the slow-mo where his helmet came up after taking that puck on edge. That was kind of nasty, inadvertent. I think Michael Frolik.
He looked like he felt bad about it afterwards.
Fro?
Yeah.
I mean, you never want to see anybody get hurt, much less a former teammate like Brent Seabrook. But Michael Frolik is one of my favorite players around the National Hockey League, always in a great mood, always with a smile and full of energy. So I thought that that was a great little gesture, and hopefully Brent's okay, but he'll have some stitches when he goes to see the family this upcoming weekend in Western Canada.
Awesome. Good to talk to you, Judd. Always a pleasure. I have gotten bitten by the bug.
Anytime, Wendy.
All right. Thank you so much. He is Judd Surratt, and we, of course, are talking about our Chicago Blackhawks. You can have a little bit of them, too. They're not just my Chicago Blackhawks.
You're going to share them?
I will. I'm just so into it. I love it.
I learned saucer pass. I'd never heard that before until Judd just described it. Had you heard that before?
No.
Okay.
I learn something new every day. I really do. All right. Bill's off this week. Steve Bertrand in his place. We have noted pet expert Steve Dale coming in. And a few strange items in the news that I'd like to discuss with you when we come back. Is that cool?
Yep, that's fine.
Right. 720 WGN. All right. Did you watch Saturday Night Live at all this week?
You know, I did. I did watch a little bit of it, but I saw the opening in a replay.
I think we don't have it.
Sorry, Strong. Kevin.
Cecily Strong, who's from this area, from Chicago, from Oak Park, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very touching because I'm thinking about it after the Donald Trump debacle. I thought highest ratings, one of the highest ratings of all SNLs, not the top, but one of the. And I thought it was such a weak show last week.
The Donald Trump one?
Yeah.
Really?
And so I was anxious to tune in, and I thought it was a really great episode, but you're coming off these Paris things. How do you laugh and be funny? And Cecily Strong started it out beautifully.
Paris is the city of light. And here in New York City, we know that light will never go out. Our love and support is with everyone there tonight. We stand with you. Paris, c'est la ville lumière. Ici, à New York City, nous savons que cette lumière ne s'éteindra jamais. On vous envoie tout notre amour et soutien ce soir. Nous sommes de tout cœur avec vous. And now, live from New York, it's Saturday night.
That's a tough way to start, but I thought they did a really good job, and her French is impeccable.
It is, as far as I know, right?
I took 4 years of French in high school, and I know how to say cheese, which is fromage.
You know how to say cheese omelette, right?
Omelette.
Omelette du fromage. I think that's a Steve Martin joke.
And I know papier means paper.
Very good.
And we were supposed to translate Le Petit Prince, and I just bought the English version and did that. The Little Prince. It was easier.
Le Prince? That's Prince?
Le Petit Prince, the
really?
Little Prince.
I didn't know that.
What did you think it was?
I didn't know. I'd never heard that before.
Sounds like someone just earned a new nickname.
The Little Prince? That would be...
Fine, we'll call you the Little Prince, Kevin. Is that what you want?
No. And then, I don't know what the opposite of a sports widow is, but Jimmy Mack asked me, you know, hey, do you want to watch the Bears? And I said, no, Bill and I have kind of given up on watching the Bears. He's like, oh, come on. So I sat down and watched the Bears game with them.
Good choice.
And then we were trying to figure out how the pack was doing, because really, ever since Mike Ditka put on that Packers jersey, and I said, he's dead to me when he did that, the Packs started losing, the Bears started winning. I watched the game, and it must have been New England as we were flipping around. They did the national anthem, and someone yelled, like, ISIS sucks or something.
Oh, right. I didn't... I heard some players reacting to that, which is unfortunate.
Well, Aaron Rodgers, yeah, they had some problems too. But there was a fan shouted out a slur against Muslims during the moment of silence. This was at Lambeau Field. Why do people do that? Wouldn't you be scared to say something during that moment?
Well, I would hope I would have the good sense not to say something like that. But I will, you know, it's.
I do not like dead air. So, you know, I am one to like to fill in the dead air.
Right.
But even I could filter myself for that.
You know, Kim Gordon's tweeting out those pictures of Mike Ditka because she's a Packer fan, and she's
I know
coming
yeah,
to terms
did you see
with the fact.
Article the Tribune put up that it, you know about the curse.
Oh, they're calling it a curse now
because the
oh,
Packers
yeah.
haven't won.
No, well, three games.
I'm saying the time space continuum. That's what I think it is. It is not, and I have a girlfriend who is a like huge, huge Packers fan. So. I sympathize with you, Kim, and Lisa, my friend, but I don't care. I like the way it's going.
I was in Milwaukee for the end of the game yesterday afternoon.
You were?
I happened to be. I wasn't at the game. I was in Milwaukee, but and you could just hear like a statewide
shutter. The end of that Packer game was just crazy.
It was great to be there.
Pretty exciting, though, the end of the game. It almost came off.
Yeah,
almost.
You're a Detroit fan.
Well, no, they got
no,
the...
No, it was exciting. It was exciting.
They could have...
They had every opportunity, and they blew it.
Well, what are you going to do? All right, we have to take a break. Noted pet expert Steve Dale will be in. I wonder what he will be chatting about.
And, French poodles.
I think it's more than that. And I still have these strange stories that were in the news that I didn't get to. So we'll do that before we get out of here. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Steve Bertrand and me, Wendy Snyder. Bill's off this week, and we're still having fun here on 720 WGN. If I want to bicker with somebody, I will wait till I get home and do that with my husband.
Steve?
No, you,
Steve. Don't look
Steve.
At me. I've got nothing to do with this.
We have noted pet expert Steve Dale in the studio and noted curmudgeon Steve Bertrand.
I agree.
You're picking fights with me.
He said some nasty things about cats.
He's just trying to get...
Just on purpose.
See, I'll tell you something about Steve Bertrand. He knows which buttons to press, and he continues to press them.
I said I missed it.
You said you missed what?
How did I pick a fight with you, Wendy?
I'm not... I'll talk to you
later.
You
don't even remember? Because it...
No, you were... I don't know. Okay. I don't want to get into it, because it'll sound worse than it is. I want to tell Steve Dale, noted pet expert, that I was... driving down the expressway, and I saw a billboard that says, now at O'Hare Airport, there is a terminal or a room for service dogs.
Yes, and or for just dogs I think that you're traveling with. I'm periscoping you, and I don't
I know
how
that's
to,
not too uncomfortable.
And I don't know how to stop it, so I just turned off the phone. I don't think that's supposed to be the way you're supposed to do
it. I think you say down periscope, and then it stops.
That's a good idea, but I don't quite know.
Yeah, it wasn't too disconcerting to have someone hold the camera up at me as I'm talking.
And panning it left.
I know,
right,
that
to
was
left.
The two of you. I just think I have problems with people named Steve. but I did see this billboard, and I thought it was pretty exciting for service dogs. And if you're traveling with a dog, I think they can relieve themselves in that room, too.
Exactly.
How do they do that? I know how they do that.
Okay.
But I mean, is there AstroTurf or something?
I don't know. I've not been there. But I maybe, and I think it's wonderful. You know, more people travel with their pets than ever before. So the concern I have, I was just at a conference, and we talked about this subject, which has been in the news, people saying they have service dogs that really aren't. So they go online, and they get certificates, they get permission, they can get a vest for like $15 from anywhere, and say they have a service dog, or in some cases, pig or llama or whatever.
So they're making this up, like a fake ID, which they're doing a fake service dog thing.
Yeah, and that's not right, you know, because there's only so many dogs that can be allowed on planes sometimes. And it's just not right. They may not be particularly well-trained or suited. They're just saying that because they want to travel with their pet and do it for free. Because service dogs, you can. And you can take larger dogs on planes with a service dog. You can't, unless it is a service dog, take a larger dog on a plane.
I want to see Tiki sitting right next to me, wearing his seatbelt, eating my pizza crusts. That would be such a fun flight.
Yeah, and I want to be sitting next to Tiki while he's doing that.
He just got a bath. He smells really good. He wouldn't bother
you.
Well, you
know,
why would you care?
In Europe...
He wouldn't use the armrests.
I battle for those armrests.
I know.
Oh, look, I was just in France. The dogs are everywhere.
That's the
thing.
In the
restaurants. Yep. When we landed, we
public transportation too, right?
I didn't notice that, but we had
yes.
Okay, then yes.
Yeah. In restaurants? Isn't there some kind of health code?
We were like at an Oasis place, grabbing lunch, you know, for half an hour, and there are dogs running around and things like that.
So imagine you walk in and they have like at a bar, a little hook. Or at some of the tables in some of the restaurants throughout Europe, they have a little hook. And I thought that was for...
purses.
Well, I didn't think that way. I thought coats for short people.
I guess you don't have a purse.
No, I don't. But that would be logical, too. It's a possibility. But they are for leashes.
How about that?
Yeah, I love it. And yes, you see dogs on public transportation. We were just in Europe about a year ago or less, and... there's a boat that we took from going from one place to another, and there
was it an ark?
No, that wasn't. There were just two dogs on the boat. It was great. I mean, you would like that, Wendy.
I think it would be cute.
Yeah.
I was at a bar out in Naperville, like a bar/restaurant. I can't remember the name of it. And it was this summer. I went with some girlfriends, and there was a dog just sitting there under the table. It was an outdoor
cafe.
Again, connected to a bar, and I was kind of surprised that you were able to have that dog. It wasn't a service dog.
Oh, in Chicago, sure. I mean, we have.
Yeah, but what if I brought my dog and that dog didn't get along with Tiki? I mean, it just doesn't seem like a right place to.
Well, we, you know, the restaurateurs that I talked to. So in Chicago, I was a part of making it legal, very big part of making it legal here, and it's always been legal actually. But that's a whole long story where Mayor Daley wanted some revenue, and he said, well, it isn't legal. And when you looked at the law, actually it was written where animals could be – only chickens could be outside or something to that effect. That's how old the law was. It goes back to the 1800s or something. So it was unclear, so we changed the state law and made it so where in Chicago, if a restaurant so chooses, it's up to the restaurant, but if they so choose, they can allow dogs on a patio or an outdoor cafe.
Just sitting like next to your table.
Totally. Totally. And there are lots and lots and lots, hundreds of restaurants in Chicago, in the city, that allow that. And many restaurants.
What if they're barking like crazy? Can they be asked to leave?
So I've talked to, so when we went through all this and we created the ordinance, talked to a lot of restaurateurs, and the truth of the matter is most people with dogs that are not well behaved just don't take their dogs.
See, that's what I'm hoping. I mean, this dog was fine. And
come on, I think you're giving people way too much credit.
I wouldn't take Tiki as much as I love him.
I want to hear from restaurateurs because right now, because those restaurateurs have told me they have more problems with little kids than they do the dogs.
I think they have more problems with people named Steve.
That's clear.
But I wouldn't, as much as I love Tiki, I would not bring him to a restaurant because he sounds like a little chimpanzee.
I would never bring my dog to a restaurant.
He wants to play with all the other dogs.
Ours have done it lots of times. And
they're good.
Yeah, we're adequate. But yeah, they're pretty good. They just do a down stay and there they are. They, you know, a lot of the restaurants come now with dog treats for the dogs. They come with bowls for with water that they serve at the table. This is not the exception in Chicago. Lots and now it is because it's so cold out, but lots of restaurants do this in the summer and spring and fall.
I'm going to bring Tiki into work tomorrow. Would you mind that?
No, I wouldn't. I'm going to take tomorrow off.
You have a dog.
I do have a dog.
There is a take your dog to work day. There really is in June.
No one's surprised by that.
All right, well, I'm doing it this year. Linda, did you have a comment or question for noted pet expert Steve Dale?
Oh, yes, I love listening to him. Thank you, Steve. My daughter lives in Sydney, Australia, and sent me a picture of a designer dog that they love. They love designer dogs in Australia, and I'd love to go visit her, but I'd also like to bring a sibling of this dog. It's a mix of a spaniel and a king spaniel. Cocker Spaniel and a King Spaniel, and they're really, really cute little dogs.
Oh,
just
I'm
adorable.
Sure. Yeah, Cocker Spaniel and an English Cocker Spaniel, probably in a King Charles
I'm
Spaniel.
Sorry, Steve Bertrand is completely checked out right now.
No, I'm right here.
So go ahead.
So your question is?
Well, can I bring little crates and just keep them on the plane under the seat? Yeah. I don't want to sedate them, you know, little puppies. And, of course, they're going to have to pee in the crate on the way because it's a long trip, but...
Well, there's international issues there. So going to Australia, no way, because they're a rabies-free country, and they actually are very, very careful. You must have your dog quarantined for a very long time. Who was it? Was it Johnny Depp? There was an actor that just got into big trouble.
I think it was
that.
Johnny Depp, yeah.
Yeah. So,
I saw it.
So going to Australia, huge problem. Coming to America, still a problem. I mean, that dog would, I think, you'd have to check with customs officials or the airlines. Okay. And a very small dog on a trip that long, sure, I guess, you know, but you can get a dog from a shelter here and you don't have to pay as much and you don't have to travel as far.
All right. Well, there's your answer. Thank you very much for calling. We have to take a quick break. And then I believe you had other things you wanted to talk about.
I do.
Just getting some news. Q Barbecue in LaGrange, which I like, allows dogs on the patio.
Yay.
We have a dog menu called the Barbecue Dish.
I love that.
Of course you do. I do, too. I have to bring Tiki there. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Steve Dale is with us, noted pet expert, and Steve Bertrand, and it's me, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. We are talking to noted pet expert Steve Dale, and we were talking about, I told you about that billboard that I saw for service dogs, and you have Vets to Pets, something that's featured on your latest podcast?
Yes. These dogs do incredible work, these service dogs. I mean, it's amazing. And I will tell you, we had in the studio a veteran who, like all our veterans, I think is a hero. And this man particularly, he served for, I think it was 18 years, for quite a long time for all of us. And he came back with post-traumatic stress disorder syndrome. And this service dog, he said, not only wouldn't he have been able to come down to WGN to do the interview, it probably saved his life. I mean, the number of suicides is off the map.
I know, for veterans. Really sad.
And we know that having a service dog changes those statistics so dramatically that they are skewed to what it is to the average American. That's how much it goes down just by having a service dog. He confirmed that. It's one thing to hear me talk about it, but it's another thing to hear this guy talk about how this dog, a pug no less.
Oh, they're so cute.
A pug. You don't think of a pug as being a service dog. But you know, a dog is a dog is a dog. And whatever these dogs do for us, however they do it, which we haven't completely even figured out, it's clear that he relies on this dog. And it's absolutely...
That's pretty sweet, actually.
Yeah, WGNplus.com if you want to listen to it. And clearly listening to him will move you. I heard, you know, I've heard back from people that heard this interview and said, yeah, I know, I've known about these service dogs for veterans, and I've met veterans who even, but listening to this was so compelling. So it's a WGN Plus where Jimmy Mack's podcast is, right?
Yes, Rebel Force Radio. And congratulations, by the way, to Carl from Riverside. He has scored our very first holiday hockey tree of the season, courtesy of Tree Time. It's a little black and red desktop artificial tree, white mini lights. It's really cool, and we have more of these to give away, courtesy of Tree Time on Pepper Road in Lake Barrington or treetime.com. Back to you, Steve.
So I'm very excited. On November 21st, I will be the co-MC with Paul Lesnick, my friend at WGN-TV, and Steve Bertrand. The three of us are going to
You're
MC.
You're doing this too?
No, I'm not.
Oh.
What is it?
The two of us will MC.
I did share a stage.
Way to get him involved, though.
It was a try.
Would you share a stage?
We shared a stage in Highwood one time.
I remember. It was a Halloween costume thing for pets, and he was...
I'm not laughing because of you, Steve Dale, because you love pets, and so do you, Steve Bertrand, but that just makes me laugh.
Me too. It did.
I wasn't laughing that day.
You did a very good job,
thank you.
I will say.
No,
an expert judge of Halloween costumes for pets. It's called the Black Cat Ball. It's November 21st. And it benefits Treehouse Humane Society. Treehouse is building a new building on the north side of Chicago. Their old facility at this point is just antiquated because of its age. And Treehouse was and is an innovator among shelters, cat shelters in particular, all across the country. I can give you example after example.
Wasn't that the first no-kill shelter?
Yeah, one of the first, second no-kill shelter in Chicago. One of the first no-kill only cat facilities in the country. One of the first to do trap, neuter, return. One of the first to say FIV cats, cats with feline immunodeficiency virus can be and should be adopted out. No problem with that. One of the first to say cats are social. What is this? The cats have to be in these cages. They can live together.
They have little trees and stuff, hence the name Treehouse. I went there to adopt a cat, and they wouldn't let me have one because they screen people pretty well, and I was in an apartment at the time. But they don't know me personally, and they wanted to make sure it was cool with my landlord. And so then I went to the Humane Society in Downers Grove, the West Suburban one, and told them my mom was my landlord. And then they called and said, is it okay if Wendy gets a cat? And my mom's like, I don't care. Why would I care?
Why are you calling me again?
Yeah. So it worked out pretty well. But I do love the Treehouse Humane Society, and they need all the help they can get with all these sweet little kitties running around.
So the event is at the Red Moon Spectacle Hall. Have you been there?
Mm-mm.
It's kind of like Cirque du Soleil when they have benefits there. All these characters come out, sometimes from the ceiling. They drop down, and it's like being at the circus, kind of. And it's a lot of fun. And for just over $100, you get a dinner. You get all the food and drink you want. Most importantly, and you'll be entertained by Paul Lesnick, myself, and perhaps Steve Bertrand.
No.
Or not. and an opportunity to help this cat shelter and help cats and help Treehouse do what it does, I would argue, as well or better than anyone else in Chicago, making me Chicago proud.
All right. And very quickly, we have like 45 seconds. There's a football player who was not very nice to a police dog, and something may happen, huh?
Yeah, this was the craziest story. So Ray Armstrong of the Oakland Raiders 2 weeks ago, as the game was going in between, I think it was at halftime, players are coming out, and he and a group of players, it wasn't only him, but he lifted his shirt up, did a Tarzan thing where he beat at his chest and went roof, roof, repeatedly at the service dog. Who does stuff like that? I've never, and the woman, I mean, the dog's getting very uncomfortable, and the handler of this dog, who's only there to protect the players, is saying, okay, sir, can you please? And he kept doing it and doing it. And
she taunting
was,
the dog.
Yeah, she was cornered. She had nowhere to go. The dog felt it had nowhere to go. The dog is at this point lunging. I mean, this dog is trained to do things to bad people.
Right.
And is at this point thinking this guy's a bad person. And he's still doing it. I mean,
can't
nobody...
you figure out that the dog's uncomfortable and it's a wild animal and you could...
Well, it's not a wild animal, but yes,
well,
your
it's
point
an
is...
animal.
Yes, yeah, yeah, it can hurt you. And but that's, I mean, it's... stupid. Who does? Little kids don't do things like that.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Well, not to that degree, you know. And if an adult says stop it, they hopefully stop it. But Ray Armstrong kept going. And this is a felony, potentially. So charges may be filed. And personally, I'm on the side of charges being filed.
Me, I mean, too.
Football players have been doing stupid things. And enough's enough. And the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, has had nothing to say about it because he's not had enough pressure to say anything about it, in my opinion, but he's had nothing to say about this.
Well, he's got bigger fish to fry.
I guess, but this goes right along the lines.
I'll
that
sign
mentality.
Your petition. Where do I yeah. sign? What do yeah. I do?
It's ridiculous.
And where
it's
do we ridiculous. Find you, Mr.
ChicagoNow.com/Steve Dale. You can read about everything I just talked about.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming by. We appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank you, Wendy, and I'll see you at the benefit on November 25th.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Why is it every guest, every person, everyone who comes in contact with you, Steve Bertrand, has an uncomfortable moment at some point in the show?
It's only Monday, and you're
oh,
really picking on me.
Oh, my God,
me.
Bill, please
I
come back.
I thought it was Friday. I didn't know.
Is he still here?
Stop it. We're going to say
I'm
hi
out.
To, I think Rokanda's back in action with Anna DeVlantis. We'll see you next 720 WGN.